Good morning.
Good day.
Isn't that a beautiful sky? What a perfect sample of summer weather.
Welcome to Broadway Radio's 2016 Tony Omnibus episode. My name is Matt Tamanini. I'm a writer and editor for BroadwayWorld.com, and I'm the co-host of Broadway Radio's Today on Broadway, which you can get wherever you find podcasts every Monday through Friday. For theater fans around the country and around the world, this Sunday is something of a holiday. While there is remarkable theater that happens every single day outside of those special eight blocks in Manhattan, the Tony Awards are an opportunity to celebrate this unique art form that, for many of us, has changed who we are as people. This Broadway season has been one of revolution, inclusion, and experimentation, and nowhere else on the popular culture landscape could you see celebrated works as diverse as what we have had on the boards this year. So, with that in mind, in this very special extended podcast, Broadway Radio founder James Marino and I wanted to engage our fellow theatrical podcasters to discuss the aspects of this Broadway season that directly relate to their specific podcast's focuses. We reached out to a bunch of shows, and while some were unable to make it work with their schedules, we were fortunate enough to have incredible discussions with the brilliant folks behind the Theater People podcast, Maximu, the Hamilcast, Broadway Stories, Behind the Curtain, The O'Henry Report, as well as a few other friends that might have a special announcement to make along the way. We also have a special segment with cast recording expert Robbie Rizel. By no means do we believe that this collection of voices covers the entire spectrum of theatrical perspectives, so if after listening you feel that you want to hear more about this season from other vantage points, I highly recommend Off Book, the theater podcast from BroadwayBlack.com, The Ensemblist from Mo Brady and Nico Graf Lanzaroni, Listen with Patty and Emily, and truthfully, there are so many great podcasts in and about the theater community, you can't go wrong. Take a chance, listen to a new show, and if you like it, great. If not, no harm, no foul. Now, we know that this episode is much longer than what we normally put out, so if you need to break up your listening into segments, we've included time codes for each conversation in the show notes in your podcast feed and on BroadwayRadio.com. Since many of the podcasters that we talk to in this Omnibus special are part of the Broadway Radio Network, I really encourage you to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Broadway Radio, and to rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcasting outlets so that more people can get to know the phenomenal talents that we have been lucky enough to bring together. So, no matter how you plan to celebrate Broadway's biggest night, in my opinion, there is no better way to prepare than with the 2.5 hours of insight, experience, humor, and knowledge that is the 2016 Broadway Radio Tony Awards Omnibus episode. I hope you enjoy it.
If I were a rich man, all day long I'd biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man.
Since the Tony nominations were announced in early May, James and the regular panelists on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, have been discussing the different categories on a fairly weekly basis. On May 8th, they broke down the races in all four show categories. Then on May 29th, they discussed the leading actor and actress categories. And on June 5th, they turned their attention to the featured acting categories. On this Sunday's show, which will come out the afternoon of the awards ceremony, they will all give their final thoughts on this season's biggest awards. While it is difficult to imagine a more knowledgeable trio than James, Peter, and Michael, if you find yourself in a high-stakes, life-or-death Tony Awards pool where picking the winners of each category could lead to either a seven-figure payday or bankruptcy, or worse, you might be looking for a safer sort of prediction than just their personal opinions. That's where our first guest comes in.
Would land like a trumpet on the ear, as if to say, here lives a wealthy man.
We're joined now by Oliver Roth. He's a producer, and we've talked about him before because his podcast, The O'Henry Report, is a new member of the Broadway Radio Network. And even though he does produce shows and he's got a lot he's working on right now, the reason we talked to him is because he has kind of boiled down picking Tony winners to a science. He is, Oliver, is it fair to call you a data junkie, a data nerd? What's the correct?
I'm certainly a data nerd.
Okay. When we've talked before, you've talked about kind of doing what Nate Silver has done for politics, for the theater community, using algorithms and data analytics to look at what we do in the theater community. And one of the things that really got you started on this was picking Tony Award winners. I know you've had an incredible track record over the last few times you've done this. And so now that we're kind of giving you this platform, don't let us down. But let's talk first about how you arrive at your picks. What is the methodology that goes into that? Is it all math? Is there a little bit of gut? Is it reading tea leaves? Is it a combination? How do you get to who you pick as your official winners?
So it's definitely a mix of things. You know, every once in a while, the math will say one thing, and I gotta, you know, my gut is really strongly telling me something else. But in general, there are a few kind of categories of things that affect the likelihood of anyone winning the Tony, the way the mathematics work is I've kind of spent time looking at the last 25 years of seasons on Broadway and Tony Awards and patterns that have occurred in things like, you know, how have the Outer Critics Circle's awards gone, how have the Drama Desk Awards gone, the Drama League Awards, all the other types of awards, the Fred Nadel Stare Awards, the Henry Hughes Awards for Design. That's a big part of it. The second thing is things like, you know, what did the reviewers think? In the years, I believe things this changed, but you know, there were a group of years where reviews were like one of the only things you could send to the voters, and you know, so if the reviews, you know, talked ravingly about a particular actor in one production, but then there were no real good quotes for another nominee. That's something to look at. There's a lot of great, I mean, this, something that's kind of new and that goes more into the gut stuff is what kind of alternative digital stuff is going on to get, you know, the general consensus about Tony voting is the performance is kind of the cornerstone, or the performance or the production or the design or the direction or whatever category it is the cornerstone. But at the end of the day, you know, the performance or the design or whatever has to be salient enough in the voters' minds to select it. So what I look at are the elements of the campaign that create, you know, a more salient nominees over others.
Let me ask this question. When you say a campaign, are you talking about like the kind of online marketing push that they get? Or are you talking about the things that producers for specific shows send directly to Tony voters?
So I'm not a Tony voter yet. So I would love to be looking more specifically at that, but I don't get sent it. But I do think that the fact that those get sent is important, but there's really no way that
gotcha.
That. I actually talked about a lot of these things in a blog post on ohenryproductions.com earlier this week about, you know, what happens during the 6 weeks between the nominations and the awards, where, you know, a lot of times on the blog I'll say, or on the podcast I'll say, last week, you know, here's a great example. Leslie Odom Jr. was the favorite to win the Tony for lead actor forever. I mean, since that show opened, through the nominations, and like, you know, I kind of was looking at things 2 weeks ago or so, and all of a sudden the story started to change. And that's a switch that I also talked about on the blog, I think it was last week. And so I wanted to kind of explore why that happens. I wrote about that recently, but it's really what we've just been talking about. It's, you know, in that case, one of the things is that Danny Burstein has swept all the other awards. So, right. You know, if we were seeing a more scattered award season for lead actor, then Leslie, you know, it would have been harder to say that Leslie wouldn't win. But the other thing was, you know, he was getting some good press. Everyone was kind of rallying behind Danny
The Kelly O'Hara of last year.
He's the Kelly O'Hara. He's the guy that everyone kind of wants. They want him, whether it's this year or last year or next year. They want to see that guy be able to say, "I'm a Tony winner." And so it's things like that. It's stories like that that start to develop that people start to get behind. I think it's important that go into the math is a huge factor. Is the show still open?
Yeah.
And you know, for each category, that matters more or less.
And okay, so we'll get back to that. Let's get back to Danny Burstein and sure. Leslie Odom Jr. Now, one of the things that is a big part of your formula and your algorithm is other awards. But for Hamilton, which transferred directly from Off-Broadway, there was only a handful of awards that they were actually eligible for. So even though Danny Burstein's accumulated a lot of these wins, most recently with the Drama Desks, we aren't really sure if he would have won those awards had Leslie Odom Jr. or Lin-Manuel Miranda, for that matter, because he's in the category as well, had been eligible for those awards, correct?
Right. Yeah, that's true. Actually, I just on that note, you know, I think you guys talked about this a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Lin-Manuel Miranda. The one thing that they could have been nominated for was the Drama League Awards.
Right.
Leslie was not nominated for that award. Lin was, and so were Alex Brightman, Zach Levi, and Danny Burstein, who were the other nominees in that category. And Lin won. And that's, you know, I think you guys had said this too. I think a little bit of that is like, thank you for what you've done to this industry. But I also think that's an interesting thing where Danny, you know, lost that award to Lin, and Leslie wasn't nominated for it, which is another kind of like, and that was the one he would have been nominated for.
So in this category, the lead actor in a musical, what is your algorithm telling you? What is your gut telling you? Do they match up?
Yeah, no. I mean, the math, which by the way, last year I started to kind of say, what can I do in these situations? Because the same thing happened with Fun Home, where, right. you know, like Michael Cervaris was ineligible for those awards, but ended up winning the Tony. And I correctly predicted that. A lot of it, 50% of that was gut, but 50% of that was me trying to find out, what can I do in these cases? And I think as the years go on and more stuff transfers from Off-Broadway, you know, we'll be able to
have the data
about that. But to answer the question, Danny Burstein is a huge favorite to win the lead actor in terms of the math and the algorithm. Leslie is actually like Leslie's third behind Lin actually. There are two things that account for that. First is that Lin won the Broadway.com Audience Choice Award, which doesn't really do much for him, but it does something. The Drama League is a huge thing because in every other year, if you win the Drama League, that means you really put on quite a performance. And Lin also, if you remember, not only was Leslie not eligible this year, but last year in the Drama Desk and Outer Critics, he was eligible for featured actor. So there's kind of a real gap in data. So gut tells you that Leslie is a close second, but the math tells you that he's actually in third and by a decent margin.
So you're sticking with Danny then?
I was just talking about this morning in my office, and I do think I'm gonna end up saying Danny's gonna win. Unfortunately, I just and Leslie's done everything he could. He was on Fallon. I think he was also
Seth Meyers, and
he started doing a vlog for Broadway.com. I think the problem is that a lot of these voters just like really want to see Danny win, I think the problem is Alex Brightman and Zachary Levi didn't do enough damage to take away votes from the people who aren't going to vote Hamilton, and I think Lin's going to steal some votes away from Leslie. So I still say, if you think it's going to be Leslie, I think that's a good guess, and I certainly think it should be Leslie, but I think Danny's going to pull off the win.
Okay. Well, that's something that leads into something else. You talked about Lin and Leslie kind of splitting votes. This isn't the only category where Hamilton actors are splitting votes from each other. And it's not the only category where there are actors from the same show splitting off votes from each other. We have the featured actor in a musical category where you have Christopher Jackson, David Diggs, and Jonathan Groff. And then you've got the featured actress in a play, which mm-hmm. is Pascal Armand and Sekhon Singhla from Eclipsed.
And actually two Noises Off people too. There's only three.
Oh, that's right. Andrea Martin and Megan Hilty too. So how do you figure that in to the algorithm where you have people who, and again, Eclipsed is another one where they weren't necessarily eligible for these predictive awards ahead of time. How do you account for the fact that people might love a show, might love multiple performances in that show, but you never know which way they're going to go when selecting them?
Yeah. So I'll tell you the way, you know, if you're a smart producer, the way you do it is what they're doing in the featured actor in a musical. Actually, sorry. So Hamilton is doing a great job for Leslie and for David Diggs. Unfortunately, Lynn is a mountain to kind of overcome. But if you look at what they're doing, Christopher Jackson and Jonathan Groff have not. I mean, Jonathan Groff's not even in the show anymore.
Right.
You know, and Chris Jackson has really not been doing much press. But David Diggs, who no one knew about before, you know, yep. Hamilton, was on Jimmy Fallon the other week, and I think it was last week. And like, he's also, I think, because he's like, he's a good story. Like, he's a good story to sell. I really hope and think that he's going to win, even though, you know, there's room for Christopher Fitzgerald from Waitress to sneak in if someone decides, mm-hmm. I want to vote for Jonathan Groff or Chris Jackson in Hamilton. That's a good example of how to kind of combat the issue, but there isn't an issue there. Actually, last year I missed on two. I selected wrong on two awards, and one of them was featured actress in a musical, because I really wanted to see Sydney Lucas win that award, and Ruthie Ann Miles won, and Ruthie Ann Miles did really well in that award season, but.
There were three actresses from Fun Home.
Three actresses from Fun Home. And Judy Kuhn was Judy Kuhn is like a Danny Burstyn, I think, too, of like, you know, she's like just everyone in the industry loves her. The way that I look at those is kind of the magnitude of the numbers. So if last year's a perfect example of where I got it wrong. Like, Ruthie Ann Miles was doing well enough in the awards that was doing so well in the awards that she was kind of destined to be the person that bested the Fun Home split. This year, I actually, you know, I was kind of looking. I'm getting ready to put out my picks, and that post is forthcoming either later this week, certainly before Friday.
Sunday, you're gonna get it out.
Although last year I do think it was Sunday morning when I put him out. I was kind of getting into the groove of it, but I was looking at it and kind of going over everything and selecting my final picks. Because, you know, by now the votes are in and it's hard to make movement. And I think it featured actress in a play is a really good example of, I think Jane Houdyshell is probably going to pull off that win, because there's not, like, Saycon and Pascal, neither of them is so far ahead that, you know, actually, as a matter of fact, I think that's a three-way tie with Megan Hilty and Angie Martin in the back, just because A, it's a comedy, B, it's closed, C, that they're, you know, kind of a little bit on another echelon of stardom now. But I think that that's an example of where Saycon and Pascal, neither has done enough to like really take all the votes. And so Jane Houdyshell, who's going to have everyone who, you know, doesn't need to decide between which person to vote for within the play.
And she's another one that is very worthy of a kind of quote-unquote lifetime achievement award as well.
Exactly. And I mean, I think, you know, the thing that kind of you can think about it as, sometimes the show earns the award as much as the person.
Sure.
In that case, that's when you start to see the split. Like, I think with Fun Home last year, you really saw – like that, it was just a beautiful small show that everyone wanted to really, you know, outperform the commercial, you know, hits that were coming out last year, the Something Rottens and the American in Paris's that were, you know, doing great numbers. And so the show was almost as strong, you know, people wanted to vote for the show as much as they did the person. What happens then is that the vote split.
Yeah. So does that lead to, talking about the featured actor in a musical, does that mean, I mean, I think from everybody who's seen this show from the public to Broadway, David definitely has that breakout role where Jonathan Groff is great, but he's in it for a handful of times. And Chris Jackson's role as George Washington is memorable, but not as impactful as Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson. So is that kind of proving your rule that David Diggs gives a breakout performance, so that kind of separates him from the other people from his show in the category.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think if David pulls off a win, which I do think he will, I think that's a perfect example of where his performance, people are not voting for him to vote for Hamilton. They're voting for him to vote for him.
Gotcha. I like that. Well, here's one that is really kind of an interesting category, because when you're talking about the shows, I think it's fairly safe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you agree that Hamilton's a lock for best musical.
No.
The Humans is a lock for best play, and I think A View from the Bridge is a lock for best revival of a play.
I wouldn't throw out Long Day's Journey yet, but it is okay. Looking like A View from the Bridge.
Okay, so at least that's a strong favorite.
Yeah.
However, in revival for a musical, I think everyone kind of just assumed that The Color Purple was the favorite and it was just going to be a coronation. And then all of a sudden, we get the Drama Desks that select She Loves Me as the winner. Now, those are very different groups of voters, but it is the last award before the Tonys. So how does that change with what you were thinking? Did it change who you think was going to win? Or is it just a small piece of evidence that, to the contrary of what everything else has already told you?
So it's funny. Actually, the math has had She Loves Me favoring for a while. Yeah. Well, it's slight. I mean, it's been a kind of tug of war. You know, the Drama Desks are definitely the most important. That's not true. The Drama League on Revival is quite important, and that went to Color Purple. But another thing that's really important that I actually don't think I talked about is the number of nominations that the show received. Yeah. And She Loves Me is definitely leading on that front over The Color Purple. So I've been saying that She Loves Me was going to probably take home that award. But so talking about when my gut and when the press and everything starts to kind of overcome the math, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I was at the Broadway League Road Conference, which is when all the presenters come in. You know, they all have votes and they come in to see the shows. And I kept hearing the story of, you've also heard this in the news, that people loved The Color Purple, that they hated the original, and that this totally changed, you know, the way they saw that show, and they, you know, they were absolutely voting for it. I heard this story so much that I was like, you know what, it's a close enough match that The Color Purple is going to be my pick. And then, yeah, on Sunday night, She Loves Me took home the Drama Desk Award. And the Drama Desk Award definitely matters. I think it's a hard category. I do think that the Tony voters, just in their kind of, you know, the way they're made up, might be more likely to vote for The Color Purple. One thing I haven't looked at, which might be interesting is, you know, one's a nonprofit and one's a commercial production. I've never looked at that before. But this category might make me look at that.
Could it be, I mean, if in a category like this that's so close, I think everybody also just assumes that Cynthia Erivo is going to win Best Actress in a Musical.
Absolutely.
Is it a case where someone could say, well, I'm going to vote for Cynthia for Actress, but I'm going to vote for She Loves Me for Revival? Is it a situation where voters could split their own votes just trying to say, this is a close one, so I'm going to give the favorite in this one, but I'm going to favor another one, the other show in another category?
Absolutely. If you don't mind, actually, that's a great example of that is what's going to happen, I think, in Choreography. So that's absolutely the case. I think that a lot of voters, they kind of want to spread the wealth. As long as they like the show, they want to spread the wealth. Shuffle Along is going to have let's be honest,
it's going to have a tough night.
All the musicals are going to have a tough night. And Shuffle Along is probably one of the ones that people were most excited for that's going to have the toughest night, because they're, you know, unless you're a Color Purple where you have a breakout star like Cynthia, you know, if you're a musical category and you're up against a Hamilton, you know, a nominee, odds are you're going to lose. So I think that Choreography is a case where even if Savion Glover doesn't merit the award as much, and I'm certainly not saying that, it's like, you know, well, we want to give it this, you know, Savion is very well liked in the industry.
Of course.
The show is, I think, very, you know, much loved, but there's just not really a way to find someone to vote for. you know, it's not going to win Best Book. It's not going to win, you know, the acting categories it's nominated for. So I think people might say, listen, you know, Andy Blankenbuehler's phenomenal, but Savion is really great, and it's either it's Savion or bust. Like it's that or Shuffle doesn't walk away with an award. Although maybe costumes or something, but
yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting one, and I think it's when we saw this historic list of 16 nominations, you started going through and saying, okay, which ones are up for grabs and whether or not Hamilton either ties or best the producers. I think now when you start looking at things like lead actress in a musical and start going into things like choreography and some of the design ones, I think it's pretty clear that they're not going to tie or definitely aren't going to best the producers. That would mean they win in every category. But it is like that's one that jumped out and said, okay, from all of the buzz with Shuffle Along was this tap dancing and how Savion was able to get these legendary Broadway stars who are not necessarily known as tap dancers to do really intense tap dancing. So this might be one of those, I definitely agree, that we see the voters breaking from the Hamilton pack. So, okay, so Oliver, tell us where we can get your full picks and all of the information on your website from the podcast, sure. Social media. Where can people find this if they need a crash course to fill out their Tony predictions pool?
Absolutely. So if you go to ohenryproductions.com and you go to the blog, which is ohenryproductions.com/blog, I have kind of my full coverage on there. All these kind of features on, for example, like specific categories or what makes someone go up and down. And I will shortly after we record this be putting up the kind of final math on it. So it'll be a full list of each category and kind of the percentage that my formulas are spinning out for each person. And then shortly after that, I'll be kind of going through and making my picks, which will be, you know, based on that heavily, but then also that's where kind of the gut comes in. So yeah. And then the podcast, which you can find on Broadway Radio, on Broadway Radio's feed, it's available on iTunes, Google Play, all that good stuff.
And that's the O. Henry Report.
Yes, thank you.
I got your back.
The O. Henry Report.
All right, well, awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to watching on Sunday and checking off which ones you got right, because I'm probably going to be using that to enter every contest I can find.
Yeah. Well, I'll be entering too, and I haven't done that in the past, so I maybe there'll be some.
I'll be happy to split it with you. Whatever it is, I'll split it with you. That's I'm fine.
Yeah, if everyone uses mine, feel free to split, you know, the
whoever wins. All right. Thank you so much, Oliver. I'm looking forward to reading it, and really excited to have you a part of the Broadway Radio Network.
I'm excited as well.
I just finished filling out my Tony prediction pool, so if any of you copy Oliver's picks like I did and steal the prize away from me, we are no longer friends.
If you knew my story, you'd have a hard time believing me. You'd think I was lying. Joy and sorrow never last. Trying not to live in the past.
The story of this season on Broadway has obviously been that of Hamilton. And while there are epic performances being given at the Richard Rogers 8 times a week, there are many other brilliant, moving, legend-making performances being given just as often all over Broadway. And who better to talk to about them than the man who has interviewed nearly all of this season's biggest stars.
My cares and my woes rolled up in my socks.
So I think it was about 2 years ago when I told our next guest that I thought that he would eventually be the Jack Parr, Dick Cavett of the Broadway community. And fast forward to today, I think I might have undersold him. He is the host of the wildly popular Theater People podcast, and they are doing so many great things. You have to follow them on social media and subscribe to Theater People. He is our friend, Patrick Hines. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, fellas. Thank you, Matt. That was the nicest intro I've ever gotten for anything in my whole entire life.
Well, you're normally the one doing the intros.
That's true. I hate doing the intros.
Oh, really? I enjoy it.
Really?
I hate it. I find that, like, when I'm trying to record them, I'm not breathing. I'm trying to get through it so quick. Like, when I don't have a script in front of me, I'm much easier. It's much easier. When I'm, like, writing stuff and then reading it, I hate it. If you'll notice, like, over the 2.5 years we've been doing the podcast, my intros have gotten shorter and shorter and shorter.
Yeah, I can't do it. I script out everything, and I might deviate from that script, but I script out everything so I don't sound like a complete... I mean, you can edit out the blithering, but you can't edit out the idiot. So I have to make sure that I record it. I write everything down first.
I'm exactly the same way.
All right.
Patrick, well, before we jump into this, tell us, when did you record your interview with Lin-Manuel Miranda?
I recorded my interview with Lin. It would have been maybe 2 years ago now. It was like just before they opened at the public. Yeah. So I think, you know what? Maybe it was even a little bit before that because the day that he came to do the interview, they had just released the casting breakdowns. So they were through their, like, it had been announced for the public, but it's still in their, like, developmental phase. So it was pretty early on. It was after he had performed at the White House when he had done that you know, the opening number for the president. But it was before they opened at the public.
So anybody who wants to write a hit show, they have to get in touch with you first, because it seems like that's the pattern.
It's really funny because, you know, I have a blog post about this on my website. I was the very, very, very first person to ever interview Lin-Manuel Miranda. I met him and this is the reason why Lin still remembers me. And when he sees me, he's really nice to me. And he always, like, says my name, like, to let me know that he actually knows who I am. I met him, you know, one of my first friends when I moved to New York was Tommy Kail, just before Tommy was anybody and before I was doing anything. And I was trying to write freelance art news articles for, like, LGBT media. And Tommy was like, oh, I'm working on this little hip-hop show with a guy I went to college with, and there's a gay character, and I think you guys would like each other. And we, like, spent a whole day together, and I wrote a little piece about it. So, like, Lin always says I was the first person to ever, like, take him seriously.
And then he completely edited out the gay character from In the Heights.
Yeah, apparently it was, like, Nina's brother who was Benny's best friend. The character's name was Lincoln. I actually saw one of the workshop productions where that character was still around, and I saw, like, his big song. He no longer exists.
We won't blame you. All right, Patrick, we brought you on to our Tony episode to talk about the big star performances of this Broadway season. On your podcast, you basically talk to all the biggest stars on Broadway. And so we wanted to see what you thought of these big star performances, whether they're from established stars like Laura Benanti or Danny Burstein, or star-making performances from the likes of Carmen Cusack or Jennifer Samard. So let's start there. Looking back on this Broadway season, what are the performances that have stuck with you as being the jumping-off point for the future stars of Broadway?
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. The first thing that comes to mind, because I'm sort of obsessed with the show right now, is somebody who wasn't nominated for a Tony Award this season, who was Helena York for American Psycho. She is incredible. And she also wasn't nominated a few seasons ago for Bullets Over Broadway. And she's just incredible. I mean, I think the whole overlooking of that show in general. I think it's one of the most, like, astonishing new shows I've seen in a long time. But I loved her. I mean, I will say, like, my biggest, like, Broadway crush this season, I have two. The first would be Renee Elise Goldsberry, of course, from Hamilton, who is just incredible. And, I mean, I begged on my hands and knees to her people for, like, 6 months for an interview. I finally got it. She could not have been kinder and, like, more humble and, like, protective of her role and just, like, so proud of her own work. And just very, I mean, she's just an incredible human, and she's an incredible performer. And I just think that... I really think that she's giving the performance of a lifetime in the role of a lifetime. It is very exciting to get to see her do that role. And then my other big Broadway crush is Carmen Cusack, who, you know, I had forgotten until I was interviewing her. My interview with her happened really quickly. I put in a request for it on, like, a Monday morning, and then at, like, 11:30 that afternoon or that morning, they emailed me and was like, can you do it tonight? And I was like, sure. Wow. I had, like, four. Yeah, I mean, I had no time to get my research together. So I didn't know a lot about her when I went to meet her. And she's incredible. And she was, you know, you could tell she had been through, like, a day of press. And she was so gracious and kind to talk to me. But I forgot that I had seen her in Carrie off Broadway. She had played the gym teacher. And kind of a forgettable role. And now, like, here she is, like, leading the company of this, like, brand new, really exciting musical. And just, I mean, she sings something like 19 songs in this show. Like, she's just she's just a powerhouse. She's just absolutely stunningly incredible in this role. I mean, it's the show is great, but it's worth it to go see her just to see her performance in it. It's almost startling how good she is.
So those are some of the ones from people making big splashes on Broadway, but you've also seen a bunch of these shows and then interviewed some of these huge stars who are just giving career-defining performances from the holy Mount Rushmore of Broadway stars who are back on Broadway this season. What are some of those roles that live up to expectations? Because when you are a Tony Award winner or a Tony nominee, it's tough to have every show you do meet the expectations of these fans who expect so much.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Danny Burstein has always been a hero of mine. I love Danny Burstein so much. And I just think that this guy in Fiddler on the Roof, I said to him when I interviewed him, like, when they announced that he was going to be Tevye, it just made perfect sense to me. I mean, and he's really different. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people like very fondly remember the most recent production. I think it was 2008, and it was Alfred Molina. Is that right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that, like, Danny, and he will say in his own words that he just was shocked that they even thought of him for the role. And I just think he's perfect. I think the production is perfect. The production is very different. It's a very, like, stripped down production on this, like, enormous stage, which I really do think that every element of that has been really thought out in terms of, like, what it means thematically to the story. And, you know, Danny is like getting the opportunity to like lead a cast for the first time. And I just think, you know, he's just amazing. He's just amazing. And he, you know, you can just see, I've described him as a glowworm because he's like, he is just so bright. He like, just like from within this man just emanates light. It's a great privilege to be in a room where he is performing. You know what I have to say? Like, I think that Lin-Manuel Miranda is just incredible in Hamilton. I think Leslie Odom Jr. is incredible in Hamilton. I think Chris Jackson is incredible in Hamilton. I think all of those performances are incredible. I think, you know, Laura Benanti in She Loves Me is just, like, riveting. And just everything you want her to be, everything that you know that she is, which is just, like, glorious and light and funny and deep and charming and... And, you know, and also, like, Jane Krakowski, like, what a surprise to get to have her back on Broadway this season in that role in that show. And she's incredible. I think she's almost 50, and she's, like, doing splits across the stage at Studio 54.
I don't know that I would be throwing out an actress's age.
Like, I know. I mean, if it wasn't easily accessible on IMDb, you would never know she's 50. She looks incredible. And one other performance I have to say from a newcomer this year that is astonishing, I think, is Alex Brightman in School of Rock.
Sure.
He's just, you know, he also having the opportunity to interview him, he's like so grateful for where he is and what he has and, you know, where he's so proud of the career that he has that has led him to this point. And he is just so full of energy and so full of, like, he just gives so much on that stage every night. And he's just, you know, he's incredible.
Do you know what his biggest problem is?
Tell me.
His biggest problem is that he is working so friggin' hard 8 times a week that he can't keep the weight on.
Yeah, I know.
He's so thin.
I know, it's true.
And he's eating 4,000 calories of carbs a day to try to keep the weight, but he's working so hard.
Yeah, it's funny, we talked about that in our interview about how, like, that's the whole funny thing about that role is that, like, he's supposed to be this, like, fat loser, but, like, he's running around and jumping onto tables and corralling children. And it's like, you know, he's like, I have to find a way to make it believable and also, like, be in shape enough to be able to pull this off 8 times a week. He's just amazing, that guy. He's so great.
He is.
So, Patrick, looking back to wrap up this segment here, looking back at this season, if you had to pick one singular performance to epitomize what this season was for you, not necessarily on the big scope and scale of things, but just for Patrick Hines, what performance would that be? Would it be Renee Elise Goldsberry or would it be something else?
Oh, it's so hard because, you know, I'm going to take the easy answer and say that I have, like, yeah, exactly. I'm going to say that I have kind of two answers. Like, Renee Elise Goldsberry, for sure, because I think that it is just so rare that an actor gets written material like she's getting. And she just rises to the occasion and her performance. Yeah, I mean, she's so amazing. But also, I think, you know, I was just having this conversation the other day with, like, somebody about Carmen Cusack, and not just what she is delivering performance-wise, but, like, when actors look at her, Carmen is not a young woman. She's certainly not an old woman, but she's, you know, I don't know how old she is, but she's not making her Broadway debut fresh out of college or even a few years after. Like, she is a woman who has, like, put in the work. She was a big star in the West End. She came back to the States, she toured, she worked in Chicago. She, you know, I think that Carmen is not only delivering, like, this incredible performance, but she is also just a like a living example to people who want to be doing what she's doing, that like you just never give up, you just keep moving forward.
I think those are two very good choices.
Thank you.
All right, Patrick, what do we have coming up from you on Theater People?
Oh goodness, well, Theater People is now a weekly podcast. We just released our 71st episode. Yeah, we launched our live summer series this year, so we're doing 4 live shows, one in May, one in June, one in July, one in August. We just did our first one with Leslie Margarita. It was a huge success. June 19th, we have our second live summer series show with Lindsay Mendez.
So jealous.
Yeah, she's amazing. I think there's 8 tickets left to that. And then in July, we have our live show with Eden Espinosa. And then in August, we're closing out the series with Laura Osnes. So, yeah, there's still tickets available to those. We are also, like, really expanding our website to make it, like, a one-stop shop to come and have, like, intimate encounters with your favorite Broadway stars. So, you know, we're writing tons of blog posts. We're adding tons of video content. So, yeah, come and check us out and get lost on our site.
What makes Patrick so unique in terms of Broadway interviewers is his ability to pull back the curtain and to coax out answers that other journalists and podcasters never even think to explore.
Wrist and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter by 14. They placed him in charge of a trading charter.
Well, I think we've gone just about as far as we can go in a 2016 Tony Awards podcast without focusing squarely on the biggest Broadway hit in generations, Hamilton. As soon as it became clear that this hip-hop phenomenon was here to stay, dozens of Twitter accounts, Tumblr pages, and podcasts popped up to further advance and celebrate this one-of-a-kind musical. For my listening pleasure as someone who has not yet seen the show, there simply isn't a better way to fully bask in the Hamilton glow than with Jillian Pensavalle and Bianca Soto on the Hamilcast. If you haven't listened to the show, these two friends and working New York actresses are obsessed with Hamilton, but not in a bad way. Their obsession has led them to explore all of the different facets of the show and its fandom, and perhaps most heroically, the Ron Chernow biography that got this whole crazy concept going.
Hamilton, and there's a million things I haven't done. But just you wait, just you wait.
So we're very lucky to have Jillian and Bianca from the Hamilcast join us to talk about our Tony Awards preview in respect to, you know, what are you guys calling the Tony Awards?
The Hamiltonies, of course. What else?
The Hamiltonies, of course. So, both of you, have you come to this this final stage of grieving where there's an acceptance level that in some of the categories where the Hamilton cast is nominated up against each other, that one of them is going to have to win and one of them is going to have to not win?
Yeah, we were actually just talking about that before, about how even if they were to win, obviously, there's no way they can win all 16, and the very most they could would be 13 if they were to win in every single category. And we were actually just having our own discussion about who we think or want or are pulling for or think is going to win in the double up and triple up categories.
Yeah, the fact that there's a triple up category is pretty amazing.
It's a Sophie's choice for you guys. Are you able to pick winners in those categories?
Yeah, I mean, I am. I don't like saying like rooting for or pulling. I don't know. I just want them all to win.
Can't they all win?
They're all winners.
Maybe there'll be ties. Maybe there's a tie.
Oh, see, more history is being made constantly with Hamilton. Can you imagine?
I think that we had talked about before that there have been ties before, but I'm not sure in these same categories. So, you know, let's
be if that happens.
Yeah.
would you think possibly the fix was in if that were to happen?
If there was a three-way tie, I would say maybe something's going on.
If there was a men. Yeah, if there was a tie between Lynn and Leslie, I think that's completely possible. And I wouldn't think it was a fix at all.
So by Lynn and Leslie, of course, you are talking about the best performance by an actor in a leading role in a musical, where we have the nominees of Alex Brightman, Danny Burstein, Zachary Levi, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and Leslie Odom Jr. So what do you think is going to happen there?
I'm thinking Leslie.
I'm thinking Leslie, too. I had a conversation today with someone who's very adamant that Lynn is going to be winning. And I said, well, he is going to be winning that night, just in other categories.
Yes.
I think.
Not saying he doesn't bring the house down with his performance. This is why these conversations just make me nervous, because I don't want anything to be taken out of context of what,
of course.
But I'm voting for Leslie because, the room where it happens, there are a lot of very subtle things. He carries the show, in the sense where just being a narrator and having to go, we talked about this on the podcast, having to go from the room where it happens and literally 30 seconds later doing Skylar Defeated. Mm-hmm. And he is the stamina and the endurance to come from actually bringing the house down and really performing the hell out of that song. And then he's not out of breath. He's not, it's like the seamless step from just like, oh, I'm
he walks off stage and he comes back. He's all composed.
Yeah.
Nothing just happened.
Yeah.
And it's just like, what?
And the final duel, and there's a moment where I'm getting chills just thinking about it, actually, when Hamilton says that Jefferson has his vote.
Yeah.
If you guys, when you see it, there are a million things going on at any moment. There are 100,000 things. But if you can maybe remember to look, if you are lucky enough to see Leslie Odom Jr., his face when Hamilton says Jefferson, he is just so, like, you could see just the air.
The wind is knocked out of him.
He's so deflated. I just think it's a beautiful performance, and yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry, Lynn. You'll win all the other ones, though.
Matt and I had spoken about before, I think no matter what happens, that we are going to see a ton of Lin-Manuel Miranda on that stage.
For sure.
So are there any categories where you think that Hamilton might not pull it off?
Yes. Yeah. And I know this is going to be painful to a lot of people, especially Bianca.
Well, I know what's coming.
I absolutely love and respect so much the choreography in Hamilton. I think I'm not going to call it an upset, because I think Shuffle Along is completely worthy of it. I don't like that term, upset. Mm-hmm. Very emotional, Tony's, clearly. But I think that if there was a real contender, it's going to be, it's that.
Yeah, I agree. Everyone knows I'm Team Blankenbuehler.
Yeah.
From the jump.
Of course.
But, and I do adore Save Young Glover as well. I love Tap Dance. I love him. I think he's phenomenal. I do think that it seems like he's the front runner, I would say, for his choreography.
Yeah, so, and, you know, well-deserved, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, the best choreography category, of course, is Andy Blankenbuehler for Hamilton, Savion Glover for Shuffle Along, or the making of the musical of Sensation of 1921 and all that followed. Hofesh Schechter from Fiddler, Randy Skinner at Dames and Sea, and Sergio Chulio from On Your Feet, which I loved On Your Feet. But I don't know if
and
you guys...
He's a fantastic and very well-seasoned and accomplished choreographer as well. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe there could just be a total dark horse that people aren't counting on.
It could happen, of course.
It could be. It could happen. So, in the women's category, did you think that anybody got overlooked, perhaps?
I mean, I think Jasmine Jones is absolutely phenomenal, and the fact that she hits that note every time, and she and just the transition between Peggy and Mariah is just it's kind of unreal. So in a way, she has been nominated, because the whole show has been nominated 16 times, guys, in case you didn't hear the news that they broke record. But I was a little, I was surprised that there wasn't a double up category with the women like there was with the men.
I was too.
Hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, what are your plans for this, the evening of the Tonys? Are you going to be live Twittering it, or what do you typically do on a Tony Award evening?
Well, we will absolutely be tweeting.
Yes.
For sure. Bianca and I are sadly not going to be in the same room, so there might be like double and triple tweets.
There will be texting
and tweeting. Room texting and tweeting. I have a 6 a.m. call time the next morning. So I will be, it's okay. I got my Hamilton to help me through the mornings. I do a lot of dancing on empty platforms, by the way, Andy, playing Bueller, in case you're wondering. I'm not sure about Bianca, but I will be attached to my phone, commandeering the television from my lovely husband, Mike, who is also interested because he loves Hamilton and who doesn't want to see James Corden just being James Corden all night long. I mean, that's going to be fun. What are your plans?
I'm actually going to a Tony party.
Is it a Hamiltony themed party?
It is a Hamiltony theme. It's a Tony themed party, very Hamiltony focused. There is going to be a very fun menu with certain items that will relate to specific shows. For instance, I will be providing burrata.
Oh, okay.
B-U-R-R.
Well, that's fun.
So, and there is a ham being made. there will be pies for waitress. There will be lots of little fun themey things.
Sugar cane and rum?
Yeah.
Perhaps.
So there's a pretty fun menu happening. It'll be a bunch of theater fans geeking out together. So as to spare my boyfriend having to sit with me on the couch,
right,
watching the Tony Awards. But yeah, so those are my plans.
Yeah,
I'm pretty excited about that.
Did you guys get into the whole Hamilton thing before or after Halloween last year?
You mean the show itself? Before.
Were you? Did you have a Hamilton themed Halloween costume?
I didn't. I very much wanted to try and get one together, but I couldn't. Well, A, I couldn't wrangle two other women to go in on a Skylar Sisters themed costume with me. And I actually think last year I didn't do anything for Halloween for the first time in a few years.
I love Halloween. And Halloween was, I think, maybe right after Halloween is when we really, really reconnected in our friendship. In our group texting obsessively. And then by January we had a podcast. So I feel like we kind of just missed the fun that could have been had on Halloween.
That's true.
In June, on June 3rd, we're talking about what Halloween costumes.
You could start planning now. You get the Halloween thing all ready and you could have a Halloween Hamilcast event. That could be fun.
That would be super fun.
And
I was at Broadway Con earlier this year, and there was quite a lot of impressive Hamilton cosplay going on there.
And there's this Hamilton sing-along coming up in Brooklyn. Are you guys going to head to it? It's Saturday, June 4th. Is it this weekend?
It's tomorrow.
It is tomorrow.
I know. June sort of happened out of nowhere. Oh, no.
Yeah. You might miss this one. I mean, we'll have one in my apartment tonight, as we so often do. But yeah, I think this one we'll have to pass on. But
I actually didn't hear about it until fairly recently. I'm pretty sad about that.
I think this is one of many that's going to happen.
I'm the last. I think we're...
Yeah. I mean, people are just now getting creative because when are they going to get in the karaoke books?
Seriously.
Come on. It's been forever. It's been long enough.
I need that to happen.
I know. Oh man, sorry in advance, everybody, but not really, because whatever, we'll get a private room, and that's whatever. That'll be the move.
So yeah. We have talked, we have referred to it, but not officially talked about the best performance by an actor in a featured role in a musical, which is packed with people who are familiar to us: David Diggs for Hamilton, Brandon Victor Dixon for Shuffle Along, Christopher Fitzgerald for Waitress, Jonathan Groff for Hamilton, and Christopher Jackson for Hamilton. So what is going to happen in this category?
We are agreeing on everything. Yeah. We are, I was going to say House David, because I'm such a nerd, but we're Team David. David Diggs on this one, I think, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Again, not to say that we don't adore Chris Jackson and Jonathan Groff. That's why it's so stressful. The performance is amazing, and that throughout even just their careers, everything they do is fantastic. And
the fact that Groff Sauce is nominated at all for being on stage for 9 minutes.
For 9 minutes.
That's so telling. And
it's his Grisabella moment.
I'm sorry, but Jefferson has my vote.
Same.
I'm telling you, everybody just wants to see what Diggs is going to wear.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yes.
Powder blue tuxedo with awesome hair.
Ideally, in my head, it's what he comes out as Jefferson in. Yeah. That purple, royal that crushed purple velvet, like insane outfit. and then he'll do, to take Bianca's word, he'll just scamper up to the podium when he wins. He'll just do that move where he's so light on his feet and wrap it.
I'm hoping for wild hair.
Total wild.
Yeah.
I don't even think it's an option. Okay. Really.
And yesterday we heard the rumor that there's an official date set for Lin-Manuel's departure. So mm-hmm. what's your feeling on that?
Sadness. My text message to Jillian, she said, well, it was bound to happen. I'm like, but it's so soon. Yay. It's in a month. Yeah.
So I'm thinking that I think that we had heard, I'm not positive though, because there's so much news around this show. Didn't we hear that that Hamilton in London is going to be starring Lin, or no? Did we not hear that?
I believe I had read in an article recently that he was considering going over there. I don't know if anything was definite or if that even came from him.
There were rumblings of him pulling an Audra, as they say.
Ah.
That's what I just said right now for the first time. Yeah, there were rumblings of it. I don't know. I can neither confirm nor deny. I have no idea of the truth on that or where I heard it or whatever. So I'm not entirely sure. I don't think he has the time. I don't think he has the time to do 8 shows a week anyway here in New York. but yeah, I don't know. But if he does, you know, awesome.
Good.
So I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule. I know that you guys are just about to record a new show, so let's get at it, and welcome to the family.
Thank you. Thank you, James. This is great. Thanks for having us.
Come on, y'all. Everyone in town is always singing a song. Shuffle-a-long, shuffle-a-long.
As Jillian and Bianca mentioned, Hamilton has a chance to make history at this Sunday's Tonys, but even if it doesn't break any records, that production has already led to so many amazing stories that it will undoubtedly live on in the minds of Broadway fans forever. Our next guest is an alum of 4 Broadway shows and is the host of a podcast that lets theater's biggest stars share their favorite stories from a life on the stage. And for our Tony's Omnibus, Todd Buonapane joined us to tell a few Tony's tales and to test James and my knowledge of Tony's trivia. Joining us now is the host of one of my favorite new theater podcasts, Broadway Stories. I think I've told the host before, literally when we were working on the expansion of Broadway Radio, I just wrote down on a list of shows I'd like to have done, just Broadway Stories.
I didn't know what it meant. I just wanted people to tell stories about Broadway. And then lo and behold, like a week or two later, this shows up on social media. And that is Todd Bonapane's new Broadway Stories podcast. It is fantastic. We'll talk about the podcast here in a second. But Todd, I think you've got some summer plans. You're going to go shapoopy down in St. Louis, right?
Oh, yeah, at the Muni. Nothing like a chubby guy dancing outside.
In St. Louis heat. You're doing the Music Man with
the Music Man.
Some guy named Hunter Foster and some other people, I think.
Yeah, it's such a great group of people. And Hunter's a great friend of mine. So, and I don't have a lot of lines in the show, but I think I'm going to be up late with him every night helping him learn his lines.
Very good. And speaking of Hunter, one of the, I think his wife was on the first episode of Broadway Stories, Jen Cody.
She was on the second episode.
Okay, so because how you do it is you have a live show at 54 Below once a month.
Yeah.
And then you record a bunch of great Broadway people telling stories about their careers, about, you know, living the Broadway life. And then you take that hour-ish live show, cut it up into two podcasts, and then release it out into the world.
Yeah, and we're doing two a month. They're supposed to be the first and third Wednesday of the month. Unfortunately, I got in a big fight with GarageBand and didn't win until today. So this month's podcast came out today, just a few hours ago, which is Thursday. I don't know when you're releasing this, but
that's right.
It's Thursday in my world.
Yes. So it's a lot of fun. It's a great show. And you've had some great guests. We've talked about your show a couple of times on Today on Broadway, but tell us some of the people who've been on your show and who are the people that are coming up.
We've had Kevin Chamberlain and Katie Huffman and Krista Rodriguez and Leslie Margarita and Celia Keenan-Bolger and Patty Murin. Everybody has been wonderful and so much fun. And then coming up, we have Andrew Keenan-Bolger, who just unfortunately closed Tuck Everlasting. And we have Kay Alicettle, who's one of the funniest people in the world, and she's in Waitress. We have Sarah Salzberg, who I did Spelling Bee with, and Steve Rosen, and Kirsten Wyatt, who has about 9 Broadway shows. She's a true gypsy, and you've seen her in a lot of things, whether you know it or not.
And she did like a cooking web series, didn't she?
She does have a cooking web series.
Very cool. That sounds like
Broadway,
a lot of fun.
Broadway nosh. I have to go over and eat a lot of weird things all the time.
Very good. Well, very cool. I have my own Broadway story about Celia Keenan-Bolger that maybe I'll tell you guys later. But anyway, so we have brought you on to talk about some stories, since that's what your show is about, surrounding the Tony Awards. So you joke on your show all the time that you are noted Broadway replacement Todd Bonapane. But so what do you know about the inner workings of that big spectacle known as the Tony Awards?
Well, I have yet to perform on the Tony Awards. The only original cast I've been a part of was Spelling Bee, and I was one of the original understudies. Mm-hmm. So they didn't put us in the number. It really wouldn't make sense. But when you're at Radio City, if you go to the bathroom in the middle of the show, it is so hard to get back to your seat. So I was in the back of the orchestra and I'm like, please, can I go back? Please, can I go back? And there were just people, you know, holding me back. And then they announced Dan Fogler won. And I said, look, I understudy that guy and I want to be with my friends. And I shoved by them all and ran down the aisle.
Price is Right type of run down the aisle.
Totally. I went to the Price is Right once, didn't get on stage, but had to fill out an accident report because someone that did get on stage got excited, banged into me, and I flipped over the seats.
Oh, the life of an LA actor.
I didn't win, but I got a bruise.
They didn't even give you like a shirt or anything for that?
No.
Was it Bob Barker or Drew?
Drew. Who was actually so funny when the camera wasn't running. I think he feels like kind of shackled by network daytime television. He's like really fun in person.
Do you think you can get him to come to Broadway?
I don't know. He's done a few Hollywood Bowl shows.
Yeah, I was going to say.
He gets very nervous when he does that.
I was going to say, didn't he do Hairspray at the Hollywood Bowl? Wasn't he Edna?
Yeah.
I think.
No. I think he was Wilbur.
Oh, was he? Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. All right. So that's a good story. You had to fight somebody to get down and celebrate Dan Fogler's Tony win. So what else do you got?
Well, these aren't mine, but I'm going to tell you Barbara Harris, who won the Tony Award for The Apple Tree. There's a famous story, and I don't know the exact person. I was doing some research online, but at the Tony Awards, she performed Gorgeous and I Want to Be a Movie Star. She blew everybody away at the Tony. She is so good. But that day, she had been broken up with.
Oh.
Now, in my research, her husband, she was married to Paul Sills. So I don't know if that was the end of their marriage, but I do know a relationship ended that day. So you see her kill it with Gorgeous. The audience goes crazy and her face just drops and she slowly walks off stage. She like was able to pull it off, but was like not even able to look happy at the end of her song.
Is that video on YouTube or something?
Yeah, you can watch it on YouTube. Watch the way she slumps off after. Oh, I've got to go sad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All right. Tell me you've got something fun, a fun Broadway Tony story to go back to.
This is funny. Frances McDormand won a Tony for David Lindsay Abaire's Good People.
With a jean jacket.
But you may recall that she wore a jean jacket to the Tonys. And this is why. So they were doing the red carpet and her manager or somebody that worked for her couldn't find her. And so they called her cell phone and said, Frances, where are you? And Frances answered the phone and said, I'm walking my dog. Why? And they're like, it's the Tony Awards. She had forgotten that they were happening that night. And she brought her dog home and just ran over in what she was wearing.
Oh
my goodness.
How can you?
Which is actually, which I love, because as a kid that grew up thinking the Tonys were the biggest night of my year, to have someone that's so amazing and it just doesn't really faze her. Because in the end, I mean, I love the Tonys, but award shows, as you get older, you start to realize a kind of bunk.
Yeah, of course.
And I'm sure where she is at in her life, she doesn't need another statue.
No, but so, to go through that month of press and build up and everything, even if you are a big movie star, you know, just kind of doing Broadway occasionally, like, how can you forget after all you've gone through over the course of a month?
Her show had closed months ago. It was a limited run.
Yeah.
And maybe she hadn't been going to all the events.
Could be.
I don't know.
Yeah. Could be. That's true.
Yeah.
But that's where the jean jacket came from the dog walk.
And that's all I remember about that acceptance speech of hers, was that she was wearing a jean jacket. That's good to know. All right. So, Todd, I've also heard that you are a bit of a Tony trivia buff. And you said you've got some trivia questions to kind of quiz me and James to see if we know these answers. I'm nervous. Yeah. James, no Googling, okay? No Googling.
Oh, no Googling. No Googling.
Okay. No Googling.
That's not fair at all.
No
Googling.
All right, yeah, I'm a huge musical theater nerd. I was always the kid in college that knew everybody's lyrics in their performance classes, even though I wasn't singing the song. I just retained.
Would you mouth them while somebody sang?
No, but... No, but Celia King Bolger was in class with me, and they told me towards the end of my 4 years that they always knew they screwed up if they saw a sharp head turn from me. And I guess what I was doing was looking down the row to see if anybody else noticed, but I didn't know that I was noticeably making people, I feel so bad about it. But I teach a lot too, and when somebody will get up and sing a song that they brought in that I didn't assign, and they'll lose the words, and I can just feed them to them, not looking at the music. And I'm like, why do I know these songs?
Yeah.
That's why there's no room for new information in my head. I can't learn how to edit a damn podcast, I guess.
All right. So what do you got for us, Todd?
All right. So there have been 5 original productions of Gypsy on Broadway.
Okay.
The show has opened 5 separate times. There have been 5 original Mama Roses in those productions.
Right.
2 of them did not win the Tony Award for Best Actress in a Musical. Name those 2 women.
Well, one would be Bernadette.
That is correct.
One would be Angela Lansbury?
Nope.
No.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
No. Did Ethel Merman not win?
Ethel Merman did not win.
That's right. She did not. That's right.
Because you've got...
Oddly enough, Gypsy won I don't know if it won any, to be honest. It did not win Best Musical. But Gypsy was beaten by 2 musicals, because in the history of the Tonys, that was the only time that 2 musicals tied for Best Musical. Can you name those musicals?
Is one Fiorello?
Yes.
Okay. What did that tie with? That would have been... It wasn't The Sound of Music, was it?
It was
The Sound of Music. There we go. All right.
Well,
I like this.
We clearly have a favorite so far.
Well, I will just tell you that the last musical I was ever in was my senior year of high school, and it was Gypsy. So there you go.
Yeah. Okay. So there's another major tie to talk about. In 1993, these 2 musicals tied for best score.
Oh, James, this is more your era than mine.
Is that a Sunset? Sunset was 94.
Sunset Boulevard was the year that
there was no other musicals.
Smokey Joe's was that year, but it was the only original musical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they gave Andrew Lloyd Webber best score just because he was the only person to be nominated. Yeah.
All right. So 1993, two shows tied for best score.
One of the scores was actually written in, I believe, the late 60s, early 70s when it was a movie.
Hmm.
Pop opera?
Oh, Tommy.
Yes.
We just talked about a few minutes ago.
Just talked about Tommy, that's right, yeah.
What else would have been that same year? All right, you got to give us another hint on this other one, Todd.
Spider-Woman? Okay.
Yes! Kiss the Spider-Woman!
I used to live on, I lived on 44th between 9th and 10th, and when I walked to work every morning, I would walk by Tommy, and I would walk by Phantom and Spider-Woman, and there was something at the Hayes, and so I was thinking about walking down 44th Street. What was on 44th Street at the same time that Tommy was there?
Very good.
All right, okay. So, going along with Back to Gypsy, Julie Stein has won the Tony, but he did not win it for his scores of Gypsy or for Funny Girl. What score did Julie Stein win a Tony Award for?
Did he write Bells Are Ringing?
He did, but he didn't win
it. He didn't win for that one? Okay. Julie Stein, what else? I can't think of anything what else he wrote. James, you got anything?
I got nothing. Let me think.
James, I hear clicking. Don't Google.
I know. If I was Googling, I'd have the answer.
Here's a hint. Leslie Uggams. Leslie Uggams is your hint.
Well, she did do a production of Gypsy a year or so ago in Connecticut, I believe. All I can hear is June is busting out all over when you mention Leslie Uggams because it's the second of June.
The Jeebus.
Yeah.
The answer is Hallelujah Baby.
Oh,
I would have never.
Yeah, neither would I. I did not know he wrote that.
Isn't it crazy that like Gypsy and Funny Girl are incredible scores, and who remembers the score to Hallelujah Baby? Yeah. But just the way shows line up, that's what he won for.
Wow.
All right.
That's amazing.
Harvey Fierstein has won Tony Awards in four different categories.
Yes.
Can you name those categories?
I believe
best
I
actor.
Can. He's got Best Featured Actor in a Musical.
Nope.
Oh, was Hairspray best lead actor in a musical?
It was.
That seems odd, I guess, just because his name was above the title, I guess.
Sure.
Best book of a musical.
Mm-hmm, for Lacage.
The play, the play with everybody
Torch
at
Song
the
trilogy.
House.
So it would have been, was it best play for Torch Song?
Yeah.
And then
one more.
He won for, it was either featured or lead actor in a play for Torch Song as well.
Best lead actor in a play for Torch Song.
There you go.
Well done.
That's a heck of a career.
Yeah. Tommy Tune also has four different categories, but I won't ask you those right now.
Yeah.
In 1987, Judy Kuhn of Fun Home fame performed in musical numbers from two nominated musicals that year. Uh-huh. Can you name those musicals? 1987.
Was one Les Mis?
It sure was.
Mm-hmm. The other one, James, you got anything?
Starlight Express.
No.
I wasn't kidding.
It wouldn't have been Passion, would it?
No. She didn't do Passion on Broadway.
I know. I'm just thinking of shows that are popping into my head. Give us a hint, Todd.
Ooh, it was a flop. Charles Strauss. Great score.
It was the Annie Sue.
I was going to say Annie Sue. Bring back Birdie.
It was a show called Rags.
Okay.
So she performed the title number Rags, which was her song, and then she performed One Day More with Les Mis.
Wow.
Not bad.
Again, what a career.
Sure.
Yeah. All right.
Three reviews have won Best Musical. Can you name two of them?
Three
reviews. R-E-V-U-E-S.
It took me a minute. Reviews. I was like, wait, what? Okay. Three reviews have won Best Musical.
Side by Side by Sondheim?
Nope.
How about Jerome Robbins Broadway?
Correct.
Okay. Did Fosse?
It sure did.
Okay, well, there's two.
That's two.
What's the
The third is Ain't Misbehavin'.
Oh, wow. I don't even, for some reason, I don't consider, I don't think of that as being a review, but I guess it actually is.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, last question.
Okay.
In 1996, Rodgers and Hammerstein earned their last Tony nomination for best score of a show that lost to Rent.
1996.
Yeah, it's would, weird. Can you name that show?
Well, it would have been a Flower Drum Song.
No. Because the ad had already appeared on Broadway.
Oh, okay.
This show was not considered a revival. It had never been a theater piece before.
Well, I admit, when you say that...
You said Rodgers and Hammerstein?
Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Okay, you say that. R&H. I think Cinderella, but obviously that's decades earlier. Never been... State Fair.
State Fair. Well done.
I got a little bit. I don't have the... I mean, I just went to Ohio State and was a journalism major. I didn't go to Michigan and was a theater major, but...
I was a musical theater major. Yeah. I was already a nerd before I went to Michigan. I was the kid with his hand up all the time.
Well, no, those are those are good questions. Those are things that if you go to one of the many hundreds of big time Tony watch parties around the country, these are things that that you could use to stump your friends and maybe make a little money if you were so inclined to gamble on them.
Money? That's not fair. I just looked up Side by Side by Sondheim because I wasn't actually sure, but it says it has the distinction of every cast member being nominated for a Tony.
Really?
For a featured actor Tony.
Well, that's, I mean, take that, Hamilton.
I know all these pools this year for Tonys aren't going to be that exciting,
it's
right?
You've got to really know your design elements to try to take away from those. I mean, there's a lot of
but they get lazy with the voting. It's like the producers was wonderful, but people were voting for like setting lights for producers when you're like, no. I mean, like Jane Eyre was that year, and I didn't love that show, but visually it was astonishing. Yeah. And like, you should be able to spread the wealth. I think the excitement this year might actually be in Best Actress in a Musical.
Really? I thought that was kind of a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, but I thought so too with Cynthia Erivo, right. But there's so many people that have said that have been going back to see Bright Star. Voters I know that are going back to see Bright Star because they're really into Carmen Cusack.
Well, that would be an upset. You heard it.
I'm telling you, they're doing a great marketing campaign for Carmen.
Well, she's the only member of the cast that gets to show up on any advertising. It's her, Steve Martin, and Edie Brickell. So,
And she's kind of the only chance.
They sing that Love Triangle song at the end, the three of them.
No, they don't.
Kidding.
Yeah, you're right. She's really the. I mean, it's going to be tough for Bright Star against Hamilton to win anything. But if Carmen Cusack can pull out that dark horse win, that's a... That'd be a definitely a big feather in the cap of that show trying to stay open a little longer.
Yeah, I hope it runs. I thought everyone in it did such a great job. And I thought Josh Rhodes' staging was so good. And I love Josh Rhodes.
Absolutely. Well, Todd, thank you so much for sharing a little Tony Broadway stories and some trivia. You made me feel like...
Of course.
I feel like, James, we equated ourselves fairly well. We didn't do great, but we didn't do terrible either in the trivia.
Well, these were an easy question, so I think you did very well.
Well, good. Well, we appreciate it. Well... Todd, thank you so much for this, and welcome to the Broadway Radio family. We are so glad to have you.
Thanks so much, guys. Happy Tonys to you.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, give it up for the School of Rock!
Obviously, neither James or I are the Broadway trivia savants that Peter Felicia or Michael Portantier or even many of our listeners are. But I think we held our own all right. How did you do on Todd's quiz? Let us know. While this Sunday's ceremony will be focusing on the best of Broadway, what a lot of casual fans don't realize is that some of Broadway's best shows began their lives off-Broadway. So when I need information and analysis of off-Broadway theater, I always turn to the Maximu New York Theater and Performance Podcast. Their panel of contributors are the type of theater smart that I only wish I could be. And listening to their show over the last few years has opened my mind and palate to so many different types of theatrical flavors that I will never be able to properly thank them. We asked Maximu's host and founder, Lindsay Behrens, to join us for our Tony special, but being the bigwig that she is, she was traveling, so she suggested that we talk to panelist and Sondheim aficionado, David Levy. All right, we're now joined by David Levy, one of the regular panelists on the phenomenal Maximu New York Theater and Performance Podcast.
David, I've always had a love-hate relationship with Maximu because I love all of the really insightful, compelling conversations that you guys have, but I live over 1,000 miles from New York City, so I hate the fact that I'll never see any of the shows that you talk about. So I've been a fan of the show for a long time, and you're kind of the Kris Kringle of Sondheimus, right?
Sure, I'll take that title.
Is that the way to pronounce it? I never know where the emphasis is. And is it Sondheimus? How do you say it?
Honestly, either is fine. I'm trying to think how it depends on what the rest of the sentence sounds like as to how it comes out of anyone's mouth. I usually say, how do I say it? Sondheimus. So I guess, yeah, Sondheimus.
Okay. All right. That's fair enough. Okay. So we wanted to bring you on because Maximu usually focuses on things that are outside of the normal realm of the Broadway community. But this season, there are a handful of nominees that started their lives off Broadway and then either directly or after a year or 10 years or something made their way into being a Tony nominated show in one way or another. So I just wanted to kind of talk to you about how those shows changed, what it means to be a part of the off-Broadway community, transferring and stuff like that. So let's start off with the plays. Three of the plays that are nominated, specifically Eclipsed, The Humans, Blackbird, all have their roots as off-Broadway shows. Can you kind of talk about what it was like for them as an off-Broadway show? What were their reactions were? What were the critical consensus for those specific plays before they even came to the Broadway scene?
Sure. So Eclipsed started at the Public Theater, and even before it played its first performance, it was very much buzzed about because of the presence of Lupita Nyong'o in the lead role, fresh off her Oscar-winning performance in 12 Years a Slave. It was a very, very hard ticket to get off Broadway. So in some respects, it almost didn't matter what the critics had to say about it. And it's interesting because this is a play, from what I understand, that's been kicking around a while and has had a hard time getting produced because it is, I guess, in very sort of not important ways, similar to Ruined, which won the Pulitzer Prize a number of years ago, which also played off Broadway and never came to Broadway. From what I understand, the only things they have in common are that they take place in the Congo during the Civil War. I haven't actually seen Eclipsed, but from what I've understood from hearing people involved with the show talk about it, from reading the reviews, that it really is not like Ruined in any other way. And it's unfortunate that people couldn't see past that, and it really was because of Lupita Nyong'o's advocacy that this show even got to the public, because she had been involved with it in graduate school. A production of it, I think, at Yale. And so when the public approached her about doing something, this is the place she wanted to do. I think because it was a sellout, it was sort of a foregone conclusion that if she wanted to go to Broadway, it was going to go to Broadway. And it was very warmly received, although it has not been selling spectacularly, which is very interesting. So my sense is that it's a play that is likely to get recognized for some of its performances, but not necessarily in the best play category.
Yeah, and that nominee right now that is kind of leading the way for that is another off-Broadway show that transferred fairly directly from off-Broadway, and that's Stephen Karam's The Humans. Different content for this show, but another one that was warmly received off-Broadway before it made the transfer as well.
Yeah, so it was funny. I have to say that when the reviews came out for The Humans, I was a little bit blindsided by how ecstatic they were. I saw it off-Broadway. I think I saw, if not the first preview, I saw one of the first few previews. And I admired the play a lot, but it was hailed as like the new great American play. I'm glad that it connected with people that way. I didn't connect to it quite so strongly. It's not to belittle it by saying this, but it's, you know, another play about white people having Thanksgiving together.
We've seen that before.
We have. In this case, the couple of things that make it interesting, one is that it takes place in the shadow of 9/11, literally, in that geographically it takes place in Lower Manhattan. And part of the story of these characters is that some of them were in or around the event when it happened, and they're still dealing with the reverberations of that in their lives today. And there's this supernatural element to it, which there's sort of a question throughout the whole play. Is their apartment haunted? Are they simply hearing things? Is it just an old building settling? What's going on? Which is funny, when I saw it again way back almost a year ago when it had first started performances, it was coming right on the heels of Annie Baker's John, which had just closed off Broadway, which also was a play that took place right after Thanksgiving, with some supernatural elements. And again, sort of like Eclipsed and Ruined, there's not a whole lot else that these two plays have in common, but that was like a very weird coincidence for these two plays to be opening back to back. Stephen Karam is really beloved among up-and-coming playwrights. Though I should say that Danai Gurira, who wrote Eclipsed, is very quickly becoming so. She had another play off Broadway this year, Familiar Playwrights Horizons, which many people said was even better than Eclipsed. But I feel like this is Stephen Karam's year. People love The Humans. He's got two movies in the works. Speech and Debate is becoming a movie, and he's written a film adaptation of The Seagull, which I think stars Emma Thompson, that's coming out this year. He just seems to have like that sort of shine on him, and he deserves it. He's doing incredible work. Even though The Humans didn't blow me away in the way it blew other people away, I admired it a lot. I see why it connects to people. And it also has some tremendous performances that I think are going to take home some Tony Gold from two really beloved performers, Reed Birney and Jane Houdyshell, who just seem, are those actors who sort of like have been working away for years and years and years. And every time they appear, they get slightly bigger notices and slightly more love thrown their way. And now it just seems like there's like a whole love fest for both of them, and they deserve it. They're great.
Yeah, absolutely. Well-deserved love. And you mentioned Stephen Karam, and he, save Hamilton, I think a lot of people think that he probably would have won the Pulitzer for The Humans. He was one of those that, if you take the big flashy musical out of the equation, he was kind of the one that everyone was pulling for. And we'll mention Hamilton here in a second. But kind of finishing off these nominated plays that started off Broadway, you know, unlike Eclipsed and The Humans, which came to Broadway fairly quickly after their initial runs, we also have the play Blackbird, which did run off Broadway, also starred Jeff Daniels, as does the Broadway production does, but that production was over 9 years ago, and so it took a while for this show to get to Broadway, and obviously based on the content of the show, that's not necessarily a surprise. Did you see the 2007 version of Blackbird?
I haven't actually seen either version of Blackbird.
Okay. So we won't necessarily get into it other than the fact that it's interesting to me that Jeff Daniels stuck with this. He did the original production with Alison Pill, who he went on to star with on the TV show The Newsroom, but she's been replaced by a much bigger star in Michelle Williams. But it's interesting to me that, and I don't want to spoil things, so we'll just say that this is a small cast show, and it is pretty tough. This seems very much like an off-Broadway show, so it's kind of surprising that it even made the leap to Broadway, in my opinion.
Well, sadly, you know, it deals with questions of sexual abuse, and I think it's unfortunately very timely. I think it's probably never not been timely.
True.
and I think star power is what enabled it to come to Broadway. To be honest, the reason I haven't seen it is because even though everyone I know who has seen it has loved it, they tend to use words like it was devastating.
Yeah.
And it's hard to kind of psych myself up to spend Broadway prices to go see a show that's going to leave me a wreck. Yeah. Although, like, you know, when you want that kind of catharsis, there's nothing better than it. But it's hard to plan in advance for when I'm going to have a day when that's what I want to feel, you know?
Yeah, when ugly crying is acceptable.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I think those are very, very good points. And the star part of the two leads are definitely probably the thing that made that transfer possible. But we mentioned Hamilton, and obviously this is really the only musical that had a direct off-Broadway to Broadway transfer this season.
Well, sort of. There's sort of an interesting asterisk that belongs next to School of Rock. Well, so School of Rock had an extended workshop last year that at the time was billed as a workshop production, and they had some of those performances were open to the public. I got to see one.
Yeah.
But they weren't. It wasn't a regular performance schedule. It was sort of like they would announce, we're going to do four performances and then go back to work and then announce a few more.
Yeah.
But then in retrospect, they've started calling that their off-Broadway production. And
really?
They released production photos from it that said from the off-Broadway production. I don't know the politics of that. I don't know if that has to do with what contracts people were working on. It's very interesting. Having seen it, it felt like an off-Broadway production. It felt like a full show. There were sets, there were costumes, there was a full band. It was great. It was very entertaining, and it made me really excited to go back and see it on Broadway. So, I think it was a really smart move, and I think it's probably part of the reason why this has been Andrew Lloyd Webber's most successful musical in probably two decades.
Because
they actually got to, you know, do the work on it that they needed to do with that he doesn't typically do, because his shows are usually so big and so hard to change once, you know, all those sets are programmed and all that nonsense. Yeah.
Was that actually at the Beacon?
No, it was at the Gramercy.
Oh, okay, so, that's right.
So it was like being in a rock club, although it was also, you know, set up like a theater.
Gotcha. Okay, so this odd quasi off-Broadway run for School of Rock aside, Hamilton is the one direct transfer, I guess, from an off-Broadway musical. And I know you are probably one of the bigger musical fans of the Maximu crew.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, I think that's fair for anyone who listens. So I don't know that there needs to be a whole lot said about Hamilton, because it's had plenty of words and inches and podcast time across the last year and a half. But, you know, I think what's more exciting for this is that it was another big genre-breaking musical shepherded by the Public Theater. I mean, even going back to the days of Joseph Papp, and then, you know, with Michael Bennett and A Chorus Line, and then recently with Fun Home and Hamilton, it's really kind of continuing this evolution of what the musical storytelling genre is that is being overseen at the Public Theater. How important is the Public, not only to Hamilton, but to what we think of as a musical in general?
Oh, gosh. The Public Theater is my number one favorite New York institution. They do such good work, not just with musicals. Remember, Eclipsed also was shepherded by the Public. But they really do. They make space for all sorts of innovation that, you know, that's like the best of why nonprofit theater exists, because they can do this without having to worry about, is it going to pay back an investment? You know, it's really, they create a safe space for artists. They also create room for people to experiment and then tweak and go back and fix. You know, Fun Home, I think, had three productions at the Public before it came to Broadway. It had a workshop, and then it had a lab, and then it had the actual production. Hamilton also did all sorts of, in their case, I think, closed to the public workshops and readings and things to develop it to the point where they could do the production at the Public. Right now they've got The Total Bent, which is the new show by Stu and Heidi Rodewald, which again, you know, it's one of those shows that has been in the works for a long time, and the Public has really stuck with it. It was supposed to be on the calendar, I think, want to say either last season or two seasons ago, and they decided it wasn't ready. And instead of just either forcing it onto the stage or saying the hell with you, they said, no, we want to do this right. And that's rare. There are a lot of other theaters in this city and probably across the country where you go and you see something new and you think, gosh, this has potential. I wish they had just given it a little more time to marinate. And at the Public, they really do take that kind of care. And they do, you know, they also have a very important emerging writers group. At Joe's Pub, they do all sorts of cabaret style performances of works in progress. It can't be overstated how many different kinds of opportunities they give to writers and directors and performers to develop work so that it can be the best work that it can be.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you see them listed as one of the three or four producers on a show like Hamilton and know that they are making a whole lot of money that then goes and supplements all of these programs, it gives, you know, kind of a nice feeling to know that that investment that they've made in people and in content and in developing content is really paying off, and then they can pay it forward to other people in the future.
And, you know, I think that's important to remember, because I think nonprofit theaters get criticized for being too Broadway focused. I know in recent years, the ART in Cambridge, Mass has gotten that a lot. I'm sure Roundabout gets that all the time. But if a show like Hamilton or a show like Pippin for the ART or whatever it is can finance the future life of that theater for years. And it at the Public, it's the story of Hair, A Chorus Line, and yep. Hamilton now are really the story of what has enabled that institution to be the institution it is. You know, I just think that is so important, and it makes me really angry when people sort of look down their noses at nonprofits that have this link to Broadway, because you know, someone's got to pay for it.
Yeah, whether you're a nonprofit or a commercial theater, you've still got bills to pay.
Exactly.
And if you can do it by supporting good work, more power to you. All right, so that's kind of the off-Broadway look. Is there anything I missed, whether it's a show or maybe some performances? I mean, I guess we could talk about Jen Samard transferring with Disaster, but I mean, I didn't see it, but from what I hear, she was by far head and shoulders the most impressive thing from that, so
You know, listen, I also didn't see that show, but that's a show that has played every kind and every size of theater in the city over the course of years. It started as like one of those backroom cabaret type entertainments that just grew and grew and grew. Some people say that it grew too big. It seems to me that the Broadway run was a calculated loss leader so that they'd be able to license it and they're going to have a cast album. And I think, you know, those producers knew exactly what they were doing. So even if we're scratching our heads at it, it's I have to understand that that was part of a bigger strategy. And again, like, good for them, you know.
I'm not mad, Adam.
Exactly. You know, the other off-Broadway story, I think, for the Tony Awards this year is sort of a sad story, which is the story of American Psycho, which had an off-Broadway run lined up at Second Stage. And then
that's right. I forgot all about that.
They got the opportunity to go straight to Broadway. They canceled the run at Second Stage, which left a lot of hurt feelings, I think. Yeah. And then they got to Broadway, and the general consensus on that show was that it actually could have used another run to tighten up and get better. And now it is closing early at a total loss, which is sad because it's a show that had a lot of potential. Meanwhile, Second Stage was able to plug that hole with Dear Evan Hansen, which is the next off-Broadway show to watch. It is, I think, just absolutely wonderful. They just announced they're going into the Belasco Theater in December, and I think that that is a show that we'll be talking about at next year's Tony Awards.
Yeah, and I think pretty much the entire off-Broadway cast is transferring with it to Broadway as well.
Yeah, I think all but one.
Yeah, so, okay, so that's kind of the off-Broadway look. I couldn't have you here and not talk about Sondheim a little bit. There are rumors of, you know, the West End Gypsy transferring to Broadway. But other than that, what's going to be the next show we see produced in New York again? Is it going to be the new show that he's doing with David Ives? Or are we going to have another revival anytime soon?
Well, speaking of the Public Theater, that is where that show is being developed. Mm-hmm. And Scott Rudin was just on Fresh Air this week and said that they think they're going to have a Public Theater production in 2017. So, you know, I don't know if it'll be the next because there's always a Stephen Sondheim revival coming down the pike. But I think it's going to be soon. You know, there right before James Corden made the leap to CBS, he was attached to A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum revival, which is a show that is really ripe to come back to New York. So it wouldn't shock me. Manny Eisenberg, I think, was a producer attached to that, and it wouldn't shock me if he's still hunting around for the right lead. But you also just, you never know these shows. You know, we're going to have Pacific Overtures off Broadway next year. John Doyle's directing it at Classic Stage. That's a big deal.
And you've got Michael Arden's doing Merrily out in L.A. And based on his recent success, you never know if that's got a pretty good reception. That could make a transfer as well.
That's right. I'm excited. I'm going to get to go see that. I go to L.A. for Thanksgiving every year, and it happens to line up with that production. Perfect. So, yeah.
What's the word there? Is it? I know they did a recent, I don't think it was you could call it a workshop or a lab for a revival of a show, but they did a kind of a week-long run of that with some fairly big stars, Titus Burgess, Steve Kazee, Melissa Jarrett Winoker. Is the word that they're going to actually do the production? Do you know?
You know, I haven't heard yet. It's never clear. Obviously, when people do these kind of readings, they do it with the hope that they'll get cast in the production.
Yeah.
But part of the point of the reading is to figure out if they have the right chemistry, if they work. You know, and also for a show like Merrily, there are so many different versions of this script and of the score to figure out which version exactly are they going to do. Yeah. They'd certainly be an interesting cast, you know, until there's a casting announcement, it's hard to say.
Yeah. Well, very cool. Well, David, thank you so much for talking to us. Where can people find you, and where can people find Maximu? Let us know where everyone can check out your stuff.
Sure. So Maximu is available on the web at maximu.com. That's M-A-X-A-M-O-O. And also iTunes, Stitcher Radio, wherever podcasts are found. Maximu is also on Twitter at Maximu. I'm on Twitter at itsdlevy, I-T-S-D-L-E-V-Y. And the best place to find me on the web is itsdlevy.me.
Oh, very nice. Perfect. Well, David, thank you so much. Enjoy the Tonys this weekend. And hopefully this won't be the last time we chat.
Thanks so much, Matt. Never can. Say you goodbye. No, 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 no. I never can say you goodbye.
For the Broadway fans amongst us that don't live in the New York City area, oftentimes our strongest connection to the shows we see on the Tonys every year is through their cast recordings. If you haven't noticed, we've been playing snippets from a number of this season's albums throughout this episode. This season has, and will continue to in the future, see some incredible cast recordings that include rap, bluegrass, rock, jazz,
disco, folky, pop, golden age show tunes, and belting that will melt your face off. When talking about the best cast albums of the season, there is no one better to turn to than diva Robby Rizzell.
All right, joining us now to talk about the Broadway season that was, in regard to cast recordings, is friend of the program, graphic artist, cabaret director, actor, social media bon vivant, Robby Rizzell. Robby, how are you doing today?
That is so many titles at the same time. I'm very tired.
They all apply pretty well, though. Okay.
I accept.
Okay, good. So, full disclosure, Robby, you are a graphic designer with Ghostlight Design and on staff at Broadway Records. So, just to get all the cards on the table before we talk about cast albums, what recordings this season have you or Broadway Records worked on?
Personally, I worked on Fiddler on the Roof and She Loves Me for Broadway this season and The Upcoming Disaster. And Broadway Records also put out The Color Purple this season and Allegiance.
Okay, so those are the ones. So just so if anyone's questioning your objectivity, we're getting that out first. So you think you're pretty good to be objective and unbiased when talking about this stuff.
Yeah, I'm pretty much a shoot from the hip kind of guy.
Okay, so let's start with those ones that you worked on. Tell us a little bit about what makes some of those special. What were some of the best moments in cast recordings this season?
Oh, I don't think that it's any shock to anybody in the world who follows me on social media that She Loves Me is my favorite show of all time. And that Laura Benanti is a good friend of mine. So I campaigned pretty heavily to design the album. And for a little while, it looked like it might not happen at all, or that I might not design it because it was with a label that I'm not affiliated with. And when it made the leap to Shookaboom, thankfully, Greg over there called me immediately and said, you're the only guy for this. And I'm really glad because it's a glorious album.
Yeah, it really is. I've listened to it multiple times already, and it's absolutely fantastic. So obviously the big elephant in the Broadway cast recording room this season has been Hamilton. What has the success of that recording specifically done for or said about the Broadway cast album market?
Ooh, I don't know that it has said anything other than when you have great product that people want to hear, they're going to get it. Otherwise, it's such an anomaly. It didn't have normal cast album producers on it. It had
The Roots.
Well, two men from The Roots.
Yeah.
And it was not produced like a normal cast album in the, you know, single day or 2 day sort of session. It was recorded like a pop album and also designed like, I'm kind of not thrilled about the design of the Hamilton album.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, they, like a show like that that's so monumental, the only thing they included were lyrics. There were no photos in the book. There was no essay in the book. It looks like a pop album. It sounds spectacular, but it just doesn't feel like a cast album in the way that collectors want it to feel like a cast album.
Robby, don't you understand that making cast album booklets, it takes a lot of money, and Hamilton really doesn't make much money.
I understand that they are destitute, really. So I get it. That little indie label that they're on.
Yeah.
What is that, Sony, or is that what they're on?
Like a SO. Yeah. but they, you know, so from a design aspect, but I also feel like they were saving a lot of their good stuff for their book, the Hamiltome.
True.
You know, but cast albums are such a rare breed and should be really designed for those collectors because they're the heart of the cast album buying world. So anyway, So it was a disappointment in that regard only. But if you don't think that Satisfied is the most played thing in my phone, you are mistaken.
Well, speaking of that, okay, so Satisfied, you're a big fan of that one.
Huge.
And across the landscape this season of cast recordings, if you had to make a, not to borrow the term from Hamilton, a mixtape of the best songs from this season, ooh, Where are you going? What are some things that have to be on there?
Cynthia Erivo's I'm Here.
I figured you were going to say
hands
that.
Hands down. She's so brilliant. Laura Benanti's Vanilla Ice Cream. So great. I was just listening to the Waitress cast album for the first time today, and it's a really wonderful cast album. And Jesse Mueller's She Used to Be Mine should definitely be on there.
Anything from any male musical theater performers, or is it all just the divas this season?
I don't the male. No, actually, Wait For It should be on there. And probably Room Where It Happens should absolutely be on there. Moving away from the the anomaly known as Hamilton that nobody talks about.
Is that a little subtweet at somebody or us?
Yes, it's a subtweet at you. That's well, definitely how that goes.
I'm not as good at social media as you are, Robbie.
It's really hard being famous. No, but moving away from that. Oh, I would say Whoa Mama from Bright Star gets a lot of play. And If You Knew My Story and Sun Is Gonna Shine Again. I haven't listened to School of Rock as much as I should, although I did buy it on vinyl.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were selling it at the theater. And I was like, oh, this is smart. This is a show that should be on vinyl. And it's fantastic. But I confess that I probably have not played the album since it came out. Just personal preferences, of course. I feel like Danny Burstein's Rich Man should be on there because he is a damn star.
I don't think you're going to get any arguments there.
No. And if I did, I would come down to Florida and find you. And probably also John Groff's You'll Be Back.
I think that sounds like a pretty good album.
Yeah, I would listen to that album. Oh, and of course, Jen Samard's Never Gonna Say Goodbye because put Samard on.
Hashtag, you forgot the hashtag. Well, and I think you guys over at Broadway Records just released that as a single, right?
We did. They rushed the single to be made just, you know, for the Tonys. The album comes out in September, but that single is so fun. It's so good. She's so good. And being in the studio, being in the studio with her after a take, I was like, now can you just do it in your Bernadette Peters imitation? And
did she do it, Bernadette?
Yeah, she did it. The Forbidden Broadway with Bernadette's Gypsy. That's Jen Samard.
Oh wow!
Yeah, go back to it. She's so funny. And during Broadway Cares, when she was in Spelling Bee, she used to sing My Unfortunate Erection as Bernadette Peters to raise money. And now I just want to hear her do everything and like Never Gonna Say Goodbye as Bernadette Peters.
I like it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right. Thank you. Robbie, okay, to end our little segment here, since I know this is one of your biggest pet peeves, can you just explain to listeners the difference between a soundtrack and a cast recording, and then explain why it angers you so much when people confuse them, like Robbie Hulk smash anger?
Can I? I'm glad you asked. Yeah. A cast recording is when a cast goes into a studio, a cast of a musical or sometimes a play, go into a studio and record the show for playback in your ear holes. A soundtrack is generally a selection of tunes, whether they're like a symphony or songs, like pop songs, etc., that are pre-recorded to a film. And sometimes there's a musical film that people that the actors lip sync to that is being played on the film soundtrack. So the reason it just drives me nuts is because we've already diluted the cast album so much already. It's not a soundtrack. Stop calling Hamilton a soundtrack. There's no film. Stop it.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's going to be filmed by July, but it's not. And I think that when you're in this industry, and there's so little to hold on to in this industry, to dilute it even further by confusing the two or conflating the two, it's, there's very little that we get. Just let us have our cast album.
I think that's a perfect way to go out. So thank you, Robbie, for enlightening us on the cast recordings of the season. We will be listening to those for the next week or so until the Tonys and thinking about you as often as we can.
I think that's healthy.
Yeah, or something. All right. Thanks, Robbie.
Have a good one.
I don't need you to love me. love.
If you are a theater fan and not following at Diva Robbie on Twitter, you are not truly living.
I've got my sister. I can feel her now. She may not be here, but she's still mine, I know.
One of the great thrills of this theatrical season has been that three of the year's five musical revivals have taken dramatically fresh approaches to material that we all thought that we already knew. In some cases, those inventive changes have breathed new life into what many considered an also-ran musical. In others, it brought an illuminatingly fresh approach to an extremely dark show. And in others, it created controversy in deviating from long-established musical theater tradition. To discuss this season's musical revivals, I chatted with Robert W. Schneider and Kevin David Thomas from the Behind the Curtain Broadway's Living Legends podcast. Now, fair warning, they did record from deep in the bowels of the New York Film Academy, so it does kind of sound like they are recording from inside a submarine, and there are a few technical issues in the first few minutes of the interview, but those do get better, and your ears will adjust to being underwater.
We are joined now by two people who, if you listen to their podcast, you immediately feel like they're your longtime good friends, longtime good friends that happen to know quite a bit more than you do about musical theater minutiae, but good friends nonetheless. They host the Behind the Curtain Broadway's Living Legends podcast, in which they not only interview Broadway luminaries, but they also often take goofy, deep side trips into Broadway's lesser-known gems with their Favorite Things episodes. They are Robert W. Schneider and Kevin David Thomas. Thank you guys so much for joining me today.
Oh, Matt, thanks for having us.
You guys just got done teaching a class together, right?
Yeah, we did. We teach musical theater audition technique for the New York Film Academy, and it was the students' first day of auditioning.
Oh, that's so. Is this the beginning of a summer semester or the end of a spring semester?
It's the beginning of their summer semester.
Okay.
And they do a 15-week intensive on the art of auditioning.
Oh, that sounds painful and tedious.
It is. we get a lot of versions of Defying Gravity, but we're very excited because by the end they don't sing Wicked, they sing A Tree Grows in Brooklyn and Goldilocks.
Nice.
That's usually where we push them.
Well, and because I listened to your last podcast episode, I know that Dorothy Fields wrote the lyrics to A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, right?
That is right.
There we go.
Thank
All right.
you, Matt.
Got to have a little love for Dorothy Fields. All right.
Always.
Yeah. So we brought you on to our Tony special today to talk about musical revivals, because on your podcast, you often kind of look back in history at the shows that defined certain generations. We thought this would make a whole lot of sense, and it shouldn't be that weird because there's only five revivals this year, and it's not like there's the 20 different shows that opened. So it would give you a nice little snapshot and let you guys kind of educate people, since that is what you do for a living. Anyway, so we had five musical revivals this season. Two were of fairly recent shows, you know, a decade or so ago, two Bach and Harnett classics, and then one show that had never been on Broadway before, yet is still a revival, which still seems odd to me in some way or another. That show was Dames at Sea, and that did not get nominated. So we just have the two fairly recent shows, Spring Awakening and The Color Purple, and the two Bach and Harnick shows, She Loves Me and Fiddler. So guys, I think maybe let's start with those two recent shows. How weird is it to see revivals that quickly of shows that were on Broadway less than a decade ago?
Yeah, isn't that incredible? It's I love that we have Color Purple, a completely new revision and a new revised version of that. We just saw it a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I'm trying to think the last time before this that I really remember was when they did that Into the Woods. I think it was like 2002 and it had just been out in 88. It felt so recent. But to have things now like Spring Awakening, is it even at the 10-year mark? No.
I think it was pretty close. It was right at it or something, but it didn't seem – by the time it closed, I mean, I felt like that one ran for 3-4 years in the original time, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is absolutely incredible. And what I'm really appreciative is that they're coming back in such different forms.
Exactly.
You know, because to be honest with you, if you remember that Into the Woods revival, it wasn't really all that different from the original production. It really didn't feel that different. And this one, I mean, Spring Awakening to integrate the ASL community, the deaf community, I think is a genius way of telling that story. And same thing with Color Purple, to come from London in such a stripped down version. This is really incredible.
So we often, you know, we think about having a new revival of Gypsy every decade or so. And we've had two revivals of Les Mis since it closed on Broadway in that initial run. But these two shows, these two revivals with Spring Awakening and The Color Purple, even though they are revivals, they feel like new shows because of the direction that the shows went.
Yeah, and actually, I think Gypsy's now going to come back every 5 years.
Yeah, we've got the West End one coming back, perhaps.
I'm looking forward to it. Next year, I think they're going to put Sidney Lucas in it, an all children's production, which we're very excited about.
I like it.
We're going to get that little kid from Manny from Modern Family to play Herbie.
Oh my God.
It's going to be a different take. But yeah, I think what's happening is that directors and producers now are getting so much more adventurous, because it used to be they would do a revival and they wanted an exact recreation of what had been seen 25, 30 years ago. And I think people now are so familiar with these stories and so much more familiar with musical theater, they're able to break the mold a little bit and they're willing to be adventurous like this. And I think it's absolutely fantastic.
And that leads me into one of these kind of classic shows that are coming back, and one of them is Fiddler on the Roof, which is really interesting about this is that not only did director Bart Lescher kind of change, I mean, he put a frame story in it and kind of changed the focus on this, but they didn't use the classic Jerome Robbins choreography, which has been done in, I think, all the other revivals.
Every single one.
Yeah.
So this is the first time we've got something different. So even with, we'll get to She Loves Me, which is not as adventurous of a far-fetched right. revival, but it's still great. But that Fiddler on the Roof is still a different Fiddler on the Roof than what we're used to seeing.
Absolutely. And I think the nice thing is it's telling theater groups across the country and across the world, yes, we've done Jerome Robbins for so long with it, and yes, he's identified with it, but now congratulations, you have permission if you want to add something through your lens to telling this story. We're more than happy to see it, and we haven't seen that before. And I think that actually is one of the most important things when it comes to revivals this season, is now people are getting the permission to deviate from the Jerome Robbins choreography. And I cannot wait to see what other choreographers do with this piece.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Kevin, I know this week you went and saw She Loves Me. And
Color Purple.
Yeah. And Color Purple. So you've seen a couple of these shows fairly recently.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about She Loves Me. What is it about this show that it just seems like it's that feel good musical gem that everybody loves, but it's not one you see produced all that often, whether in New York or around the country?
Yeah, I know. I'm constantly fascinated by that. When I was a kid growing up in Elmira, New York, I remember the director wanted to do She Loves Me, but didn't do it because nobody knew it. And yet everyone says that this is one of the most perfect musicals that ever existed. It's a beautiful little gem of a musical. And I hope that this revival has shown people and communities and schools that this is worthy of being done all the time. It's a beautiful little throwback of a show. It's so sweet. And I think this revival didn't change anything per se with it, but it honored the piece for what it is. And I think that's what needed to be done with this piece.
And I also think when you think of Golden Age musicals, you think of all the big brassy things. And this show is such a sweet little gem. I think it just got lost in the shuffle.
Yeah. Well, and it is very different. I mean, it's I wouldn't call it a chamber musical, but it's a fairly small cast.
It's no intimate.
No big dancing ensemble of waiters or anything like that. I mean, right. It's a fairly small show. And I can see that, like you said, Robert, kind of it does not stand out when you've got Hello Dolly or
Fiddler.
Or My Friend. Yeah. Okay, so we talked a little bit about these productions, but what about these performances from the different stars that are in it that separated them from maybe their predecessors in those roles, whether it was Danny Burstein and Fiddler from all of the great Tevyas in the past, or Laura Benanti and Barbara Cook as Amalia? From these performances that you saw in the revivals this year, what was different? What was unique about these star performances?
Well, speaking for Danny Burstein, and this, I hope this comes off as a compliment, other Tevyas have been so larger than life. Danny's Tevye looks like he really is
a part of the world. He is not the world. He is a part of the world. And that is something I don't think we've seen before, which is a fiddler in which all of the relationships have equal weight to them. And I think Danny's subdued performance, and I mean that as a compliment, I think really enlightens a lot of stuff in Fiddler we hadn't seen previously when it was dominated by such big, great stars, big, larger-than-life personalities. And I think that's fantastic. So that's yeah. Danny's for Fiddler, which I think is remarkable.
And I loved Laura Benanti in She Loves Me, mostly because I enjoyed seeing her comedy and quirks that she often has in real life. I mean, we all follow her Twitter, yep. and we all know the funny videos, her Fosca in Times Square, are you kidding me? And I mean, come on. And so you see, you know, an actor and actress cannot disguise who they are fully. And you, she brought a lot of those quirks into the part that I had never seen before. And I thought that was utterly charming and fascinating with it. That and it showed that you can do these roles, oh my gosh, so many different ways. I mean, there's no one way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you saw She Loves Me this week. You also saw The Color Purple this week. And as great as Laura Benanti is, a lot of people think that the favorite for the Best Lead Actress in a Musical, Tony, is going to go to Cynthia Erivo.
Oh, hands
for
down.
The Color Purple.
Matt, last night, I'm still reeling from seeing the show last night. I never in my life, and I know everyone's talked about it, but I've never experienced a standing ovation that was instant after a song. I mean, there was no other option but to stand and scream. It was just one of the most breathtaking performances. The acting in it was sublime. It was there's nothing but realism, and the voice is a powerhouse voice. And I love the original Color Purple. I saw it 3 times.
Did you really?
I confess that now. Now I'm embarrassed because this one's so like amazing. But the other one, I liked the other one. And this one, oh my gosh, it just I want to say it improves on it. I don't know how much they tied together a little bit more the music. It felt like it was song after song, and I appreciated that. I thought the direction was just out of this world. The way they presented it to the audience, and the audience just ate it up.
We've talked about some of these shows that are revivals that are nominated. There was one that we mentioned that wasn't nominated, the only musical revival this season that didn't get nominated.
Yeah.
And that's Dames at Sea. And this is a show that I think when people said, hey, it's coming to Broadway, a lot of the Broadway community said, really?
What?
Yeah. It's like a 6-person show. What, you know, why is this going to take this big leap? First off, did either of you guys see it in the unfortunately short run?
I did. Not only did I see it there, I saw it at Infinity in Baltimore when it first got started.
Do you think that this little intimate tap dancing, you know, show, did it make sense to try to do it on Broadway?
Honestly, I don't think so. I love the show. I love the people behind the show. This is, if you are going to do this, I think you need to have a very intimate space. And even though the Helen Hayes is like the most intimate space on Broadway, you still need a tiny little, you know, 70, 99 seat theater to really get the full effect of it. And I think the fun is taking this tiny little campy jewel and watching it up close. I think the bigger the venue and the more overproduced it gets, it kind of dissipates what the original intention and the original message of the show was.
And this show is kind of, I don't think lampooning is the right word, but it's definitely playing with those big seafaring musicals, Anything Goes, Anchors Away. And so to make it on the same scale as some of those shows seems a little odd. It seems a little out of place with this show.
Yeah. And when it was done in Baltimore, it had that sort of take on it. And then I think as time went on, it just got a little bit bigger because I think that's what Broadway audiences are expecting. I would love to have seen it come into a smaller off-Broadway house, and I think it would probably still be running.
Which is very interesting.
Very silly, very fun.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got these 4 shows that are nominated for Best Revival of a Musical. We've got The Color Purple. We've got Spring Awakening. We've got She Loves Me. We've got Fiddler on the Roof. Not to put you guys on the spot and anger anybody in the community, but do you have a favorite? Do you have either one that you personally like the most or one that you think is the favorite to actually win the award?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, from my perspective, I saw them all. I'm really, really moved by each and every single one of them for many different ways. But I think it's going to be Color Purple. I think Color Purple is going to take home Best Revival.
No doubt in my mind, it's got to be Color Purple.
Is that what you think is going to win and or
both.
What you want to win? Yes?
Both for me, yeah.
You know what? This is Rob speaking.
Uh-oh.
I think it's going to be the Color Purple. I really wanted to be She Loves Me.
Oh.
It seems like with all of these, there's something very special about each one. And we didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about Spring Awakening, but that, you know, incorporation of the ASL and to think about, I've never been a Spring Awakening huge fan.
Me too. I'm the same here. Yep.
Yeah. But even from the original production, what I appreciated in it was kind of the movement and the choreography and the rawness to be able to keep that authentic beat with a cast that has a lot of their members who can't hear is really special. Yeah. And I thought that was really moving. And for some reason, ever since this show first started out in LA, I was fascinated by it and really moved every time I got to see some performance of it. So I wish them well, but I think you guys are probably right that The Color Purple, if that doesn't win, it'll be an upset no matter who does.
Yep.
Yeah, and I really want the Spring Awakening to have a longer life. I want it to go across the country. I want it to go across the world. I think people need to see the magic that's happening there. I think the drawback on that one, and I hate to say this, I hope it doesn't offend anyone, I think the text and the score of Spring Awakening is not nearly at the level as the other revivals this year, and I think that might be one of the things that's holding it back.
Yeah. No, I think we're all in agreement that as a piece itself, Spring Awakening is not my favorite, but I love the idea and the concept behind this specific production. Thank you guys so much for talking revivals with me. And Robert, I hope the show this weekend goes incredibly well. Thank you so much. Did you guys have any big Tony plans? Are you going to have a party or anything?
Yeah, actually, my husband and I are trying to plan a Tony party, but we're trying to get like themed food and drinks. So like ham for ham sandwiches.
Nice.
So what we really need from your listeners is ideas and suggestions on what those food and drink items could be.
All right. So where should they send them? Tweet them to you?
Tweet them to me at Rob W. Schneider.
Okay. All right. Ham for ham sandwiches. I like that.
That's Thank you.
Obviously, you got to have the vanilla ice cream.
Oh, yes. That's genius.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's a given. Yeah. All right. Those are good. All right. Well, thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Matt.
And I hope that you aren't keeping any students out of a classroom to record this.
They're all just waiting sadly outside with their defying gravity cut.
Here she is, boys. Here she is, world. Here's Rose.
Now, you're probably thinking to yourself, I've been following the Broadway season pretty closely, and I don't remember a revival of Gypsy opening this year. Well, you would be half right. No revival of the Lawrence, Stein, and Sondheim classic opened on Broadway this year, but as David Levy and I mentioned earlier, there was a critically acclaimed production that hit the West End in 2015 and is potentially eyeing a New York transfer. If the Imelda Staunton-led Gypsy does make the transatlantic trip, it would be joining a number of Tony-nominated shows that originated in London before making a splash on Broadway this year. To discuss the mini Broadway British Invasion, I chatted with John and Matt, the two amazing artists behind the glorious Curtain Call coffee table book that I've spoken and written about before. As you will hear in our conversation, they have been fortunate enough to have an extremely unique view of the London hits that took Broadway by storm this season. Like with Rob and Kevin in The Submarine earlier, the string and soup can that we extended across the Atlantic for John and Matt can sound a little tinny and hollow, but the insight of these two is well worth suffering through it. Also, Matt had to jump off the call right before we started discussing Cynthia Erivo, so that's why you won't hear him in the later part of this interview.
Hold your hats and hallelujah, mama's gonna show it to ya. Ready or not, here comes Mama.
All right, joining us now from across the Atlantic are the two authors, creators of the fantastic Curtain Call. It's more than just the book, because you guys do more than the book. We've talked about it before. I've written about the book. It is Matt Humphrey and John Schwab. They've done some incredible work covering the 2015 British theater season. And I guess we can go ahead and say it. We're officially kind of announcing you guys as part of the Broadway Radio Network.
Yeah. Yes, we can.
Which
yeah,
is awesome.
Great. No, it is awesome, and we're looking forward to, you know, you guys have helped us out when it comes to, you know, we've been chatting to you for almost a month now, and trying to get things going, and we're new to the podcasting world, as it were, and we are. really excited to kind of put it out there on the Broadway radio network, really, and premiere, as it were, on the Broadway radio network.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a complete pleasure to be part of your network. It's fantastic. And to be able to kind of reach new audiences as well is a great opportunity for us. So thanks for having us.
No, absolutely. So just so people know, we're going to talk about some of the British imports, so to speak, for the Tony Awards, whether it's shows or actors. But just so people kind of know your bona fides, what is both of your backgrounds and, more importantly, maybe where did this idea for Curtain Call come from? What has it become? What is your future of what Curtain Call will be?
Wow, that is a massive
series. We don't have too long, so just, you know.
Well, the history is Matt and I met when Matt was on the stage crew at the Old Vic Theatre in London, and I was on stage. I was understudying for a show there, Speed the Plow. And Matt and I met and became friends and kind of fast forward 9 years. And Matt was working on a project for the Hat and the Empire and created a book about being backstage for a year at the Hat and the Empire. And separately, I had an idea about doing a London-wide book about London theater and a website. And we just kind of hit each other up at the same time. And it kind of grew from there. Matt, do you want to?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I started working at the Old Vic about 9 years ago. My background to this story, I guess, is that I was working on the stage crew and taking photos whilst I was doing that backstage. So my perspective has always been from the other side of the cloth, I guess. And I've always been fascinated with the whole process of putting on a production and the amount of people involved in that. So that put together with John's 20 years experience of being on the stage as an actor, we felt was like a perfect combination to kind of go in and tackle the plethora of amazing theater that is on stage in London every year.
Yeah.
Well, so right now you guys have a book out that was released earlier this spring that includes a ton of incredible backstage photos that Matt did. And while Matt was taking those photos, John, you interviewed members of the cast, crew, backstage, you know, administration while the show was going on. And that's what we are turning into a podcast.
That's correct. Right. Yeah. So Matt and I, when we started the project, we kind of knew we wanted to do a book, and we knew we wanted to have the website, and it was going to be a photography led idea. And then we realized that, if we could talk to the cast and crew, just get in there and have informal and chat is such an English word. And as an American, saying chat is wonderful, but just sitting down and having a discussion with people backstage while the show is going on and having a discussion with people about process of being on that stage at that time, at that theater, and letting the wider public know and theater fans and theater professionals hear about their experiences about doing that would be a kind of a great expose, as it were, on what we as performers and we as theater professionals, and it's not just performers, it's about the crew and the company, what that it takes to get a show on. And from that perspective, so with Matt being in the wings, because of course I'm not able to talk to people while they're about to go on, so Matt is there capturing that moment. I'm kind of I talk to them in their dressing rooms and in the green room. So there's a kind of a progression of, wow, there's that moment of them getting ready, and then there's them about to go on stage. And the podcast, you will be able to hear that wonderful kind of the mix of excitement and anxiety and everything else that you experience as a company member putting on a show.
It's really fantastic. I've heard some of the early kind of cuts of the interviews, and you've got a teaser trailer, kind of, so to speak, that will be coming out here very soon. So it's very exciting. So, but let's go from that. Now that people know who you are, know that you have legit credentials to talk about British theater, let's bring it back to some of these shows that have really made an impact on the New York theater scene this season that originated either in London or in the West End specifically. Let's start with the show that really is maybe not the shoe-in, but is definitely the favorite to win Best Revival in a Play, and that is the Ivo Van Hove production of A View from the Bridge. That is a show that you
have a very nice spread in the book. So talk about that show. What were your experiences backstage at seeing this show and kind of observing it up close?
Right. Well, this was one of the huge privileges of the 60 shows that we covered last year, was to be able to cover A View from the Bridge, because it had a second life in London, had a very limited span when it opened at the Young Vic Theatre in South London, and then transferred to the West End. And by that point, it kind of created such a huge buzz in London that, you know, it was a really hot ticket. So we were thrilled to be able to cover it. From a backstage perspective, it was quite unique, because you had onstage seating in a proscenium arch theatre. So the whole layout of the theatre was quite different. And the aspect of being in the audience and being able to kind of see through the drama happening on stage and see audience members on the other side must have been thrilling for people watching it. From our perspective, it was actually probably one of the hardest shows to photograph it was all so open. So there was nowhere that I could stand where I couldn't be seen by an audience member. So to try and get any kind of feel for the show was really quite tricky. So I had to be quite inventive with that. But it was a challenge that I rose to and really enjoyed and thrived on. And actually, you know, the spirit of the life of any show that we cover kind of transcends from the stage to the backstage area. So it's as much, you know, the backstage area is sometimes quite an extension of the vibe that you have within the company on stage as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think Matt, Matt Tamanini, I should say, you've seen the book, so you know that Matt, having come from a background of being on a stage crew, knows where the best perspective is to kind of view a scene. So there are moments in the book that there's one shot that Matt got from the fly floor that you may, as an audience member, may have never thought, oh, that's a great angle. And it's in a pivotal moment in the play where Matt went, I want to capture that from the fly floor, because it was one of the best views. And as an audience member, like with Matt being able to kind of get up there and show that to you, it gives you a completely different perspective of what the onstage company were kind of going through. And if I can add, it was A View from the Bridge is one of the first shows, Matt, I think it was in that first kind of group of shows that we started out covering. And so it was one of our first, maybe in the first five or six, Matt, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was one of those shows that we kind of got in there through the back door in a way.
Yeah.
Because I knew one of the cast members who actually transferred with the cast, Nicola Walker.
Yeah.
And so I kind of, you know, asked her whether she thought the rest of the cast would be up for it. And she was like, yeah, absolutely. Let me talk to them. And so it was really thrilling to be able to be invited in so openly as well. And then to see that they, you know, they won a bunch of awards over here before transferring to Broadway. So it was great to kind of to see this incredible piece of American drama, which had been brought to life in a completely different way by, you know, a Dutch theatre company in a small theatre in South London, to then transfer back to its kind of its home, I guess, and now to be kind of reaping the rewards of it is a fantastic thing for British theatre, but it's also great for Ivo van Hove's company as well. So,
well, and he seems to be the director that anytime a new show that sounds interesting pops up, it sounds like he's directing it. So I feel like we're going to see a lot from him.
I think he has a twin brother, because he's directing so much at the moment. I don't know how he's doing.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And this is not the only show that he has on Broadway nominated this year. Another Arthur Miller show, his production of The Crucible, has a number of nominations as well. So very exciting fantastic. Time for him. But Matt, you mentioned that this was kind of an American show that has kind of circumnavigated, you know, half of a hemisphere before coming back home. The opposite is kind of true for King Charles III. This is obviously a very British show, started in London, is about a very British topic about Prince Charles, you know, eventually becoming king. And yet it's come over here. It's nominated for Best Play. A lot of the a number of actors and the director, Mike Bartlett, is nominated.
Yeah.
So that's another show that you guys were able to feature in your book. Matt, you obviously, I think people can tell by the accents here that you are originally of British descent.
Yeah.
John, you are not. You're an American who's been living in London for a long time. So talk about how this show is not only representative of British theater, but how does it represent, you know, the British culture and politics in general? Because for those of us that see it in New York, it's just, it's a play. We don't really understand the social ramifications of something like this.
Yeah, I think it's okay to say this, John. When we went backstage to cover King Charles III, you know, we spoke with Tim Pigott-Smith, the lead actor, about it and about the imminent transfer to Broadway. I think he shared some anxieties about whether it would translate to the American audience, because it is such a British theme and it's such a British play, and there's so much of the writing and the sensibilities and the humor in there which is so British that I think we were genuinely a little bit anxious as to how it would kind of transfer, but it seems to have gotten down so very well. I mean, it's a new play by Mike Bartlett, and it won the Best New Play last year in the Olivier Awards, and deservedly so. It's just a fantastic piece of writing, and obviously it's got an audience that appreciates it outside of not only London, because it did a UK tour, but outside of the country in Broadway, but also in Australia. You know, there's been an incredible tour for this play. So it's had a life beyond, you know, like A View from the Bridge. It's had kind of several existences and several lives, which is a fantastic thing.
Yeah, I had a really good conversation with Tim Pigott-Smith. I believe that he went to Broadway with Enron.
That's right.
And it wasn't received so well. I mean,
understatement.
Exactly. Yeah. So you kind of have the same creative team. You've got, not creative team, but you have some of the same creatives putting together a play. And Tim mentioned to me, and I don't think he'd be too upset with me saying this. He and it's in the book. He said, if you read the interview that's in the book, he said, well, the transfer, it would just have to be kind of, well, let's see how it goes. It's one of those things where if you're in a play, and we've recently had a couple of discussions with theater creatives where a play transfers and it plays so well in one theater and doesn't in the next, and it can be in the same town, and you kind of go, why? Because there are different audiences for different theaters. So Tim was, I can't say he was anxious, but he was aware of the fact that it may, King Charles III may have not played as well on Broadway as it did in the West End, but he was very excited about the possibility that the audiences might get that this is a story beyond politics, beyond kind of the royal family. It was a very personal story about somebody who was expected to achieve so much and yet was powerless in his ways to achieve it. I mean, it's a fantastic play. I mean, it really is.
Well, it's a much different show than The Audience, which you guys were able to cover in your book, but it's a much different show than that, but it does show you that while the content of the show is very much centered on, you know, the British royalty and things like that, there is an appetite for that in New York, and it's a little different one because this is more of a comedy, and the audience obviously featured Helen Mirren, who is a star among, you know, unto herself, which draws a lot of people. So it's interesting to see that a show like this has not only found a bit of an audience in New York, but is, you know, critically acclaimed. You mentioned Tim Pigott-Smith. He's nominated for Best Performance by an Actor in a Leading Role in a Play. So I'm very excited to see that this one transferred well. Another show I wanted to talk about, though, is Matt, you mentioned shows kind of having a different life in different places. And John, you talked about playing in different theaters. Florian Zeller's The Father, directed by James McDonald, while the New York version was directed by Doug Hughes, and the sets are different. They're completely separate productions, even though I think their runs overlapped quite a bit, too. So talk about that show and what, for the people who have seen the New York version, talk about what the British production looked like.
Well, it's a fascinating life that the play had here. And, it, you know, it started at, Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, it started at Theatre Royal Bath.
That's right.
And the company kind of created it there and then went on a tour and then came in the West End and went back out on a tour and then came back into the West End. So it's had an incredible life. And where the cast has changed, but Kenneth Branagh, who won the Olivier this year for best actor in a play, he's been with it since its inception, and because he loves the writing, and I think that there's something in the writing that does something for the play, does something for the actors. People are attracted to it, and whether it be a different set, a different director, a different lighting designer and sound designer, whatever. There is something about the play that in the writing that attracts both audiences and theater professionals to it to get it out there.
Yeah.
Do you know off the top of your head, did Christopher Hampton do the translation that played in London?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so it's the same translation that's here in New York.
Yeah.
It's just a different production. Okay, because I wasn't sure since it was a written in French, if there was multiple English translations.
No, it's just that one official translation, I think. We actually spoke to Florian Zeller, so that may be one of the podcasts that we put out. You know,
yes.
You never know.
Oh, awesome.
He happened to be there the day that we visited, which was just such a stroke of luck. But regarding the Broadway version of this play, I'd be really interested to see what the set was like, because in the UK version of it, what you had was, you know, as the story kind of unfolds and the play unfolds, and this man's life starts to kind of unravel, so does the set. So various pieces of furniture started kind of disappearing from the set in between scenes. And then by the end, you've just left with nothing. I think, but a chair, was it, or a bed? I can't recall. It was a bed, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So I'd be interested to see whether the staging and the set was similar in that respect or not.
I don't live in New York, so I haven't seen it, but I know that there is quite a bit of play with furniture coming on and off and changing. So I think that's still there. And for all I know, it might be written into the script.
It could well be, yeah.
Yeah. Well, those are the plays, and that kind of seems to be, it kind of goes in waves and shows that transfer from London to New York. Sometimes it's a lot of musicals, sometimes it's a lot of plays, but there's one major musical that's come from London to New York this season and is a favorite to win a number of awards, and that's The Color Purple revival directed by John Doyle that originated at the Meunier Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
And this is one that has a lead actress and Cynthia Erivo, who is the favorite to win. I think a lot of people would be shocked if she doesn't win Best Actress in a Musical, who really was unknown to most New York theater-going audiences. This kind of predates Curtain Call, but did either of you guys see this production when it was at Meunier's?
No, we didn't. And I can tell you this, it was a huge ticket. And think about the Meunier Chocolate Factory. It is Matt, unless you could experience what it is a... it is such a small theater.
Yeah.
Right. And it is maybe, I can't tell you the number of seats, maybe 150, 200 seat theater. So that transfer is, transferring to Broadway blows my mind. I was aware of when it was on, but I'm not able to kind of comment on the revival. It is astonishing to know that The Color Purple is up for awards at the Tonys when it was this lovely little show and it that played in London, that was kind of born of the Meunier Chocolate Factory, which does produce some of the most incredible theater in London.
Absolutely. Now, were you familiar with, if you didn't see this production, were you familiar, either of you, with Cynthia Erivo before that? Is she a known quantity in the London theater community?
No, yes, she is. I mean, the kind of the way that Broadway stars are kind of held up on a pedestal, as it were, in Broadway or on Broadway, it's not the same. It's just they're kind of working actors here.
It's a different, you know, perspective and approach to the job and the life and all that stuff. And it's just interesting to me. Very rarely do you see somebody come out of nowhere like she has and take the community by storm. It's one thing to win an award. It's another thing to completely bowl over the entire community, which she has done.
Yeah.
And whether she stays here or goes back to the UK, I think she has won a lot of fans on this side of the Atlantic, which from every report, she completely and utterly deserves it.
The fact that Cynthia has, you know, cut her teeth on the West End stage, and she's not only done musicals, she has literally done things like Midsummer Night's Dream at the Liverpool Everyman, and I saw her at the Dalmar Warehouse in Henry IV. You know, to see her making it big on Broadway and being nominated for Tonys is an incredible thing. I mean, she's built up such a huge stage CV, resume, whatever you want to call it. I'm calling it CV because I'm in England, but her resume is incredible. And for any professional would love to have her resume, her stage resume. To see her making it and killing it in New York is an incredible thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I want to end this, John, just on a real quick thing. I know there's a number of shows that you guys profiled in the Curtain Call book that either have announced runs in New York this coming season or are rumored to be coming to New York. I just wanted to kind of get your, not that I'm asking for reviews, but just kind of give us a little sense about what these shows are. And let's start first with, you mentioned not a lot of British musicals going to New York, but there is one with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Now, granted, some of the writers are American, but tell us a little bit about what that shows.
Yeah. So Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was a huge story here in the West End. And, you know, especially with Sam Mendes directing. I mean, and there is not a theater professional, a musical theater professional, who didn't want to get kind of audition for it. And Charlie is a wonderful production. And it is a visual feast, and it is so ripe for Broadway, and covering in the book, Matt knew he was going to get amazing visuals, and the amount of people that it takes to get this show on is unbelievable. We talked to the company manager, and he said, you know, it was about 150 people a night it takes to get this show on, and that is that is, you know, with the backstage and with the writing and with the musicians and with the, you know, the entire company is about 150 people that it takes to get the show on per night. And I think that is a phenomenal statistic. And it just goes to show what a collaborative thing theater is. And, you know, I think New York is going to love Charlie. I do.
That's awesome. Well, and what's interesting, though, is that it will have a different director for Broadway. I don't know if you knew that Sam Mendes is no longer attached to it in New York. So it's Jack O'Brien is taking over with all that Sam does both on stage and on screen. It didn't look like the schedules worked out, but it is one that with the writing team of Scott Whitman and Mark Shaman that people are really excited to see.
I think that they're excited. And I know that there are different sensibilities when it comes to, and expectations when it comes to what a Broadway show is and what a West End show is. And I love the fact that they're revisiting the material to put it on Broadway. And I think that, you know, that is the right thing to do. And I think that it can only benefit from that transition.
I think this would be not appropriate to discuss now, but I think another conversation would really be interesting is the differences between UK musicals and London musicals and New York musicals. I think that's an interesting conversation for people who aren't as familiar. But just a couple of the other shows, Photograph 51, which I saw a production of it here in Orlando, is planning a transfer with Nicole Kidman, who, you know, despite her movie star acclaim, got a lot of really positive reviews for this show in London last year.
No, absolutely. And it was one of the tickets to have. And, her return from Blue Room, she did Blue Room at the Dalmar Warehouse, which, you know, her performance was famously described as theatrical Viagra, you know, and I think that Nicole Kidman has a vulnerability that when you're able to experience it in person and up close, that Photograph 51, if you can get a ticket to it, get it. It's a historical piece of theater. The story is, if you don't know, it's about the, you know, discovery of the double helix DNA discovery with Crick and Watson. And I think that Nicole Kidman's return to Broadway, her return to the theater is going to be an event that you shouldn't miss. If you can get a ticket, get one.
Absolutely. And the one that's rumored nothing confirmed. There are rumors that Roundabout is going to bring in the Imelda Staunton revival of Gypsy that ran and swept a bunch of awards last year.
Well, Matt, you know, what can I say about Gypsy? I mean, you know, the cover of our book is a photograph from Gypsy. Gypsy basically just that production that came in from Chichester Festival Theater, and it was a transfer. Chichester, you know, let's give a big shout out because they produce an amazing amount of theater, and they're a great feeder theater for the West End. It is an astonishing stripped back production where the band, the big band, is there for you to hear, and they're going to be as loud as you can take it. The design is as stripped back as it can be. It's basically about the show. And Imelda Staunton, I don't know how the hell she did 8 shows a week.
Wow.
And she is, I hope she doesn't mind me saying, she's about 5 foot nothing, and yet she can fill a theater that most of us would love to be able to fill.
That's awesome. Well, hopefully that one does make it across the pond. It's been a full 8 years since Broadway's had a Gypsy revival, which is unusual for us in New York. So hopefully we get that one. But Matt had to drop off the call a little bit to take care of some stuff. So John, thank you for both you and him for giving us some insights into these shows that made their way across the Atlantic this season. And thank you so much for everything you've done. And we're looking forward to having you as part of the Broadway Radio Network.
You know what? We cannot wait. Awesome. We cannot wait.
Sugar, 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 butter, sugar, butter, sugar, butter, flour, sugar, butter, flour, sugar, butter, flour, sugar, butter, flour.
Well, that's it. That is Broadway Radio's 2016 Tony Awards Omnibus Special. Did you make it all the way through? Do you need some electrolytes, potassium? Maybe eat a banana. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed these conversations as much as I did, because I really, really loved being a part of them. I also hope you learned something about this Broadway season from our amazing guests, because they are a mountain of incredible information. James and I will be covering all of the Tony action on Monday's episode of Today on Broadway, so if you somehow missed the broadcast or want to relive the highlights, join us then. And in the meantime, James, Michael, and Peter will have a new episode of This Week on Broadway on Sunday afternoon, where they will put a bow on the season just in time for the Tonys. Thanks for making it this far into this behemoth of a podcast. My name is Matt Tamanini. You can find me on Twitter at BWWMatt. Subscribe to Broadway Radio and iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever you get podcasts. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And most importantly, have a happy Tonys weekend.
Kitchen baking, what a mess I'm making.